for the most part, people would not countenance such a thing. So it takes a strong central bank to provide for an empire such as our empire or the British Empire or the empires that have gone before. Now you would think, in the face of the calamity that we have just suffered, wouldn't you think that the Senate would be a little bit more skeptical about reappointing for yet another 4 years the fellow whose tiller was on the hand of the ship of state or on the financial ship of state while all these excesses were generated, and yet with practically no debate to speak of, he has been reconfirmed, or is being in the process, I guess, as we speak, of being reconfirmed for another 4 years. But, you know, you can't have an empire without a strong central bank, and the American people really badly need to wake up to that.
Yeah, they do, and they're not aware of it. And also the fact that Bernanke has so easily been reinstalled is, you know, it doesn't really surprise me, though.
No.
It's just what's going on. The corporations have basically taken over in last week's decision to allow corporations to freely fund political campaigns because they're considered individuals, too, is part of this whole takeover.
And to show you how the fix is in, I think this is as good evidence as anything that you will find. I mean, the extent of the destruction that the American people have suffered. I know the people in the Washington corridor are doing quite well, and you know, people in the marbled halls of the Federal Reserve don't really understand. They don't suffer this. I watched the Senate for an hour today on C-SPAN, and you know, they're all doing quite well, and you know, they haven't missed any meals or anything. But you know, the people in America have really had a body blow, and they're, you know, they're losing their homes and they're unemployed. People are wondering how to use George Bush's term, food on their family. Conditions are very, very difficult. People that are planning for their retirement have their retirement hard upon them, have seen the value of their savings collapse. It has been a nightmare. So under the circumstances, doesn't the magnitude of the losses cry out for an examination of what happened without prejudice? Doesn't anybody with healthy human consciousness say, the destruction has been so severe, we need to seek out the views of the people who warned us about the calamity before it took place? Because, so help me, the existing power structure did not have a clue it was coming and did not warn us about it. Look, Ben Bernanke was the, and I don't want to make this about Ben Bernanke, but he's symbolic of the way the whole system works.
Yeah.
Ben Bernanke was the chairman of Bush's Council of Economic Advisors. In October 2005, he went to Congress, and he testified, housing bubble, I don't see any housing bubble, I'm not concerned about a housing bubble. So a year and a half later, when it was apparent to everybody, he testifies to Congress. By this time now, he's chairman of the Federal Reserve, and he testifies that the problems in the subprime market are contained. So he clearly didn't see the bubble while he helped froth it up.
I know.
But yet he's confirmed now for another 4 years. But let me ask you, if the people who have suffered this losses have any merit as citizens of this country, they have any value as members of our republic along with us, doesn't the extent of their losses cry out and say the power structure must consult the people who did see it, did describe it to a T, and yet they refused to do so?
I know. And there is no vehicle, there is no way to have a say.
No.
It's pretty well, it's by law, and there's no avenue to be heard. The media is owned by corporations, and it's not telling the truth, so people are confused and overwhelmed and terrified. And you write about the fear premium, too, quite extensively. And what was it, Wartime Confessions of a Talk Radio Heretic? It was brilliant.
Oh, yeah, I had kind of a checkered career doing what you're doing as a talk show host. And I found myself in a situation where I was surrounded by warmongers during the lead up to the war in Iraq, and I distinguished myself in my opposition to the war, and it actually set a very, very promising broadcasting career back rather severely. But I gave a talk the night
oh dear.
Yeah. the night that the war broke out, called Confessions, Wartime Confessions of a Talk Radio Heretic, talking about my experiences about the war. But I identified three things that are necessary for one of these kinds of elective
endeavors.
And unnecessary wars. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and one of them I think is fear. Mm-hmm. And oh my word, did my industry, did the broadcasting industry, did the media serve as the handmaiden of the governing classes of the Washington power structure in propagating fear? I mean, the tone was practically hysterical. Do you remember the sound of the Fox News alert? I mean, a car would roll over and end up in the ditch in rural Virginia somewhere, and it'd be Fox News alert, is terrorism responsible?
I know.
It
was
unbelievable. And of course, this is the kind of thing that was good for the media.
Yes.
Because, you know, fear is a narcotic. You know, people get hooked on it. People sat around mesmerized listening to the latest alerts from Fox News, and the idea that we were in dangerous times was very, very compelling broadcasting. And so of course, you know, you remember how ridiculous it became as people rushed out to buy plastic sheeting and duct tape.
And duct tape. And then you had to support the troops. It's not that you weren't supporting Americans, but what the troops were actually doing was killing. It was war. That's what drove me crazy, and no one spoke about it, but you wrote about it. I had the hardest time agreeing to it. On some level, we were all part of that sin. Actually, my co-host just arrived, Hope for Peace.
Hey.
Hi, Hope. How are you?
To meet Hope. This is Charles
Goyette. Wonderful. I'm really loving this conversation. It's wonderful.
Thanks for having me on your show.
Oh, thank you so much for coming. And we've touched on so many important points really already so quickly. I was interested when you were talking about people who had warned us already about the impending doom. And one of my favorite ones is Brooksley Bourne, if you know her. Do you know her story? Brooksley Bourne. Oh, I get to tell that really quickly and fast because it's not my show. Actually, she's interesting in terms of the media because there's a wonderful front line on her, and that's the only way I know this. And she was warning about derivatives. She was head of the she became head of the division that was supposed to be potentially regulating derivatives. She actually tells a story where her first meeting with Greenspan. I'm going to just shorten it really quickly. He said that you and I will disagree fundamentally on policy. You probably would want to go after fraud, and we don't go after fraud. So you can see her sit and, you know, tell this to the camera. But most people have never seen that. And she did warn. She, there were congressional hearings on it, and she was trying to get them to regulate derivatives really heavily. This was just in the beginning, like I'm thinking 98. About that time, and she fought Greenspan, and Greenspan really just stood up and said, you know, these need to be unregulated, and this, you know, this has to be a shadow industry, and it's a dark box or whatever they call it.
Oh.
Who are you thinking of when you think of people who have warned us?
You know, I have a section in my book, The Dollar Meltdown, in which
fantastic.
I quote Congressman Ron Paul introducing a bill that would have completely stopped this. And you think about it now, this is several years before the bubble popped.
Uh-huh.
And he describes, it is simply uncanny.
Uh-huh.
He describes in complete detail
how
if this is allowed to continue, if this reckless behavior on the part of the Fed is allowed to continue, how it will unfold, how it will burst the housing bubble, the mortgage bubble, what it will do to interest rates, what it will do to America, what it will do in terms of a recession. Years in advance, he described, it is so uncanny, it's like watching the... a play-by-play of something that hasn't happened yet, and then it transpires just exactly the way he's described it. But you would think, under the circumstances, wouldn't the American people want the monetary authorities, the fiscal authorities, to consult the people who described this thing to a T, who described the debacle and the reasons for it in advance?
But it's
instead
obvious.
Of the people like instead of the people like. Greenspan and the rest of them that either had no clue or behaved as though they were clueless during the whole period.
Mm-hmm.
But the people who are correct about these things are not questioned, are not invited to be a part of the discussion, are not consulted when the new plan to bail us out is created. Instead, it's the same old people who, it's like somebody sells you a map and they march you deep into the terrors of the triple canopy swamp, malaria-infested nightmare. And you get in there, you're hopelessly lost, and then they show up and they want to sell you another map.
I know.
Who would buy one from?
But people do buy it.
They do. They're doing the same
thing. They buy
it. And I
think
part of
that
is
the fear. You're right, completely.
The fear and the monopoly of the media, yeah. All that deceit.
Sure.
There were certain elements that you talked about that are creating the economic collapse and that go hand in hand with war. It's a profit make.
Wow.
It's a way to profit.
Yeah.
Well, it's not the first time this has happened. I mean,
No, it isn't. But we're
over
we
and over, and it's always the same notes. Sometimes it's a different octave, but it's the same notes over and over and over again.
But
of course, we're going to see a lot of this now. In my view, I mean, I was just reading something from Plato. You think about this, 2,500 years ago, he was talking about, in the face of these kind of economic difficulties, as things deteriorate, you know, a good ruler is quite capable of stirring up some foreign enemy somewhere to take people's minds off the trouble.
And then demand obedience. And, in a crisis, we have a central authority.
And the difficulty we have here in America is the other side also has religion all bound up in that. And so that's actually their theology of faith. You know, so that compounds the whole thing and really keeps them tied to that, because that's their salvation. You know, you can't go to heaven unless you're a Republican.
Well, it's pretty shameless, you know, the way the Prince of Peace has been marshaled as the head cheerleader for war.
Yeah.
It's been unbelievable. But I want to know why the people who have been right about this stuff from the get-go,
these
Cassandras, the people who have been prophets in all of these things, they are lost in the din of the idiots' conventional wisdom that get us into the mess.
Yeah. And we keep buying it.
Well, we're not getting accurate information. We're being kept in the dark overall. You have to scratch the surface to see what's really going on and listen to people like yourself, Charles, who have the background and can give. I didn't know much about the economy at all until it started to fall apart. And I've been treading a mill trying to see what it is.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm
hard
inviting
to get
you
good
on.
Information.
Can you give us a little history in terms of how the dollar melted? What caused all this briefly, and then...
Yes. I'd be very happy to do that. The couple of key events in... freedom requires a certain amount of decentralization. If you have a highly centralized governmental structure, then you have authorities and administrators, boards and bureaucrats and czars and commissioners making decisions. So I know that you both understand this, that really, if there's any salvation from so many of these problems, it lies in decentralization of everything, decentralization of our education, decentralization of our media, decentralization of our government. But in this particular crisis, it requires massive decentralization of the monetary system. The monetary system, in the past, people used gold as money, and this is something that has endured in human history, gold and silver, has endured in history as a monetary forms for thousands of years. The centralizing authorities, the mighty hand of the government steps in and wants to control this. And it's gone on since days of old when there were goldsmiths that served as some of the early bankers, and they would hold your gold and issue you a receipt or a claim check or a warehouse receipt for the gold that they were holding on your behalf. And people, for convenience, would trade these paper receipts instead of bothering to go to the goldsmith, check out their gold, and carry it around on the streets. They would just trade the receipts. And that was really how paper money was born, or at least how it developed, and it spread quite rapidly with the creation of the printing press. But the early goldsmiths found that they had they could form a relationship with the kings of the time. And the kings would use the goldsmith, and they would enforce in their kingdom that the particular goldsmith's money be used, and that no competing monies could be used, and so on. And this began the process of a real high centralization of paper money. So by the time the United States was formed, we still had the founders of the country had been through the experience of bad paper money, of worthless paper money created by central authorities. We had the expression, not worth a continental. They had gone through the experience of the continental dollar that turned up to be worthless.
Yes.
And so they created a decentralized monetary system in which the states were forbidden from making anything other than gold and silver payment for debts. It was a constitutional provision, and they gave the federal government the right to regulate the creation, the weight of to coin money, effectively coin, not to print money. They knew the difference, but they said to coin money. Well, anyway, in the 1930s, Americans were still used to using gold coins, $20 gold pieces, and so on, and they would carry warehouse receipts. Paper money was only a warehouse receipt or a claim check. It was just like giving your car to the valet. You'd have the claim check, and then if you ever wanted your car back at the end of the evening, you give them the claim check, you get your car back. But in the 1930s, Americans were forbidden by the central government from owning any gold, and it was not only were they forbidden to own it, but in addition to that, owning monetary gold was a crime. Now think about this.
Wow.
Punishable by $10,000 fine and 10 years in jail for owning some inert substance that represents no threat to anybody. It was a crime to own it. Well, at that point, the American money became effectively irredeemable. In other words, paper money, because of momentum, because of their habit of using paper money for the generations prior, people continued to use the paper money, but it was no longer redeemable in anything. There was still some paper money redeemable in silver for a while until the 1960s. But I want to describe this because it shows you, this will show you how the American people are being set up to get fleeced again. Because what happened? The gold was all called in by the government at the prevailing price of $20. It was actually $20.67 an ounce. They called in all the gold under penalty of law.
Now what year was that once more?
It was in 1933.
Okay.
They
so
called
they,
in
it
all
lost
the gold
value. They were
in $20.67. Now, once people had complied and turned in the gold at $27, the government suddenly, now they have the gold. Then they raised the price to $35 an ounce. Now, they didn't raise the price to $35 and say, turn it all in, we'll give you 30. Once they had it all, they raised the price. But now I'm going to describe for you a three-part step in the way that the American people get fleeced in these deals. Because once they penalized or criminalized the owning of gold, the American people could not own gold. But foreigners continued to own gold, but now foreigners could turn their gold in and get $35. Now the Americans had been forced to turn in all of theirs at $20, but foreigners could still turn in the gold that they had and get $35. So their purchasing power had just jumped considerably, while Americans were forbidden from participating in that windfall. So the American dollar was devalued by whatever it was, 60%, literally overnight, but the windfall was found by foreigners who would do business with America.
Why? Why do you think this was a problem?
Well, maybe I could come back and tell you that, but it was it basically had to do with the wish of the monetary authorities and the elected officials to devalue devalue the U.S. dollar, to undermine the purchasing power of the U.S. dollar. And just to fast forward the story, I'll do this really quickly, to fast forward the story just a little bit. Up until after World War II, Americans persuaded most of the rest of the world to hold U.S. dollars as their currency reserve. So the central bank of other nations, instead of holding gold as they had once done, the central banks of other countries, the treasuries of other countries, were persuaded instead to hold U.S. dollars as the reserves, and just as they had issued their own currencies at one time against those holdings of U.S. dollars or of gold, now they held U.S. dollars. And the United States said, look, if for any reason you don't trust us, you can turn those dollars in, we'll give you the underlying gold. And in fact, some countries did not trust the dollar, and they did not trust the monetary authorities, and they did not trust the Federal Reserve and the printing press and the ability to create money out of paper and ink. And so, for example, Charles de Gaulle sent a warship over to the United States to pick up all the French gold because they did not trust. They saw the United States running the printing presses, making the paper dollars cheaper and cheaper and cheaper, and did not believe that they would be able to claim the gold that these paper dollars represented. So this was the case until 1971. Now, think about this, because up until 1971, for foreigners, the U.S. dollar was still redeemable in gold. For Americans, it was illegal. But foreigners could stand in line, at least, and turn in their paper dollars for gold, and they did it in a big way. The more dollars they saw the Federal Reserve creating, the more they decided to turn in these U.S. dollars that they'd been holding overseas,
sure.
Euro dollars, petrol dollars. They turned them in, and they did so fast that in August of 1971, President Nixon closed the gold window and said, "That's it. We, you know, our the it's like
it's
the
no
jig
longer.
Is up. We've printed more dollars, more claim checks for automobiles at the valet than we have automobiles to give to patrons.
Mm.
We've printed too many false claim checks. So, but the Americans got stuck holding the bag on that one because foreigners up until that time could still get gold for the U.S. dollars that they hold in substantial amounts. Now, fast forward to this bailout business of 2008.
Mm-hmm.
You heard the appropriation that we had to do this during that debate. We have to bail out Freddie Mac. We have to bail out Fannie Mae. We need $200 billion, and we need a pronto, and they need more now, and they needed more last month. They need more. And what happened? Did you see anybody, any homeowner that was upside down in Kansas get bailed out? No.
Absolutely
you
not.
You saw Fannie and Freddie made liquid again, so that foreign investors in Fannie and Freddie, like China, could sell out their positions in Fannie and Freddie and roll them over into U.S. Treasuries that are guaranteed instruments of the U.S. government. So the whole bailout, once again for the third time, bailed out foreign holders of investments in the United States at the expense of the American people.
Yeah.
And it is ongoing. Over the year and almost a year and a half now since the calamity first hit really hard, there's been no deleveraging. You talk about deleveraging, all these banks highly leveraged and so on. The only thing that has happened is that these financial institutions that willingly undertook the risk of loss
willingly,
in hopes of
exactly.
making massive gains, yep, in they and who dazzled us with their financial footwork and their fancy stepping for billions of dollars worth of fees over the years, suddenly the losses that they incurred in their recklessness or their behavior got transferred from them to the American people. And so now the Federal Reserve, for all of its other sins, it's even worse now because now the Federal Reserve is nothing but a broken-down hedge fund, and all of that toxic paper, all of that
paper.
Waste paper has been transferred from the financial institutions that were dabbling in it at their and
wow.
were masters of the universe, after all, and it's been transferred from their books. They've been made whole, and it's been transferred onto the account of the Federal Reserve. And,
so,
and that means to the American people who will pay those losses by a deeply devalued or depreciated dollar and a lower standard of living.
So you're saying
that
the banks no longer hold those toxic assets. The Federal Reserve does?
Yes, $750 billion or as much as $1 trillion has been transferred onto the books of the Fed.
And there's so much money floating around, too, that it is worthless.
Well, you haven't seen anything yet. I try to describe
We've
it this way.
Printing the, like the, crazy.
The Federal Reserve, you go look up a chart of what's called the adjusted monetary base. It's the best indicator of Fed policy. The adjusted monetary base, since the market meltdown, has exploded. I mean, it virtually doubled overnight. So this is new money that is created by the Federal
wow.
Reserve. And that money is sitting in accounts with the Federal Reserve, money that belongs to, they're not loaning it to the American people. They're not loaning
they're
it
not.
To people to start businesses. No. It sits in the Federal, this is money that has been given to the banks, the banks have, that they leave on deposit with the Federal Reserve. It's called the adjusted monetary base. And here's the way that works. Until the banks start loaning that money, right now they're leaving it with the Fed, and the Fed encourages them to leave it there.
Why?
Well,
collateral of a sort?
The Fed is a dirty little secret. The
yes.
Federal Reserve has used all of this monetary policy to recapitalize the major banks. They suffered huge losses from their bad behavior, And so the Fed has adjusted monetary policy at the expense of the American people to reliquify these banks. And I'm going to get a little wide of the story if I start telling you, but it's not the first time that this stuff has happened. I mean, the when Alan Greenspan headed up the Fed in the 1990s, the major banks were upside down, and Alan Greenspan engineered another credit bubble to reliquify the banks, and you saw them drive interest rates down to 3%. So you had Merrill Lynch and J.P. Morgan and Chase Manhattan. They were upside down. Their stock prices were in the tank. So Alan Greenspan manipulated the marketplace to provide cheap liquidity to the banking industry. And the stock prices of all of those companies exploded. And this is what we have done again. They have provided cheap credit to the banks, cheap money to the banks, to reliquify the banks at the expense of the American people. But the story I really want to tell you is what's coming next, because all of that money, while it sits in the Fed, it doesn't really create inflation. And in the dollar meltdown, I try to describe it this way, and the story starts to be a little complicated, but if you read the book, I take it very slowly, step by step, so that you'll understand. It's like a race car at the starting light of a race. It's like a dragster or some other race car at the starting light. And you hear a lot of noise, and the engines are revving, and they're redlining, and the tacks, you know, screaming up to redline, and the engines are racing, but nobody goes anywhere, nothing happens, until they pop the clutch. And then when they pop the clutch, the cars, you know, take off in a cloud of dust and the smell of burning rubber and the screech of racing engines, but nothing happens until they pop the clutch. So now the Federal Reserve has created this huge expansion of the monetary base, and it's just sitting there. Prices don't explode. We don't get hyperinflation or out-of-control inflation in this country until they pop the clutch. And by that I mean when the banks start to lend again, as they inevitably will, that's how they earn their living.
Yes.
When the banks start to lend again, this money that the Federal Reserve has created is a huge increase in the money supply of the U.S. dollar, and it will create an enormous inflation in this country, out of proportion to anything we've experienced at least since the 1970s.
That's how it's going to happen. I was wondering, because of the supply, oversupply.
Well, we have a fractional reserve banking system. So if the Fed creates $100 billion, it's just $100 billion in new money. But you put it into the banking system, and we have a fractional reserve banking system. So, a bank takes if they make the deposit into the bank of $100 billion, the bank lends out that amount of money many times over. They hold a reserve of $100 billion, and they lend out $800 or $900 billion. Mm-hmm. So now you get this. This is unlike,
worthless,
you know, in the Weimar Republic of Germany. They ran the printing presses to inflate the money supply. Mm-hmm. They just ran the printing presses night and day, 24 hours a day, printed the money. Finally, they wanted to print the money so fast, they started printing the money only on one side of the paper. And they poured out paper money, and they ruined the economy of Germany. They wiped out the middle class, which was historically the middle class is kind of a barrier against the intrusion of tyrants, but it prepared the way with the smoldering resentment of the German people, the destruction of prosperity and the destruction of the middle class, and worse conditions on the poor. They prepared the way for the advent of Hitler and the National Socialist Workers Party. Mm-hmm. But in the United States, the new mechanism it's not anything as barbaric as just running the printing presses. It's all done by digital bookkeeping entries. They can create the money out of thin air with a bookkeeping entry, but when the banks start loaning that money, they loan the same money out many, many times over, then you get an explosion in consumer prices in this country.
So that's what we have to look forward to.
And it's already being telegraphed to you by the global price of things like oil and the global price of gold. I mean, you think about it.
Astronomical.
You know, the reason that they're getting so much attention. When Bush became president, oil was, I think, $35 a barrel. It's twice that much now. Since Greenspan took office, the price of gold has virtually doubled. All of these things are signals. They are indicators. It's very sensitive barometers the opinion of the global economy about the quality and the quantity of the U.S. dollar. And so we saw a case, I don't know, 6 weeks ago or so, when the Central Bank of India, very much like our Federal Reserve, they have reserves too. And I described how after World War II, the central banks of the world were mm-hmm. persuaded to hold U.S. dollars as their reserves and issue their own currencies against their holdings of dollars.
Right.
So a few weeks ago, the Central Bank of India looked at this big pile of U.S. dollars in their reserves on the one hand, a big pile of U.S. dollars, and they looked at gold bullion, big pile of U.S. Mm-hmm. dollars that are presented, that are printed at no cost, the cost of paper and ink, or mm-hmm. a big pile of gold bullion that can't be printed, can't be created out of thin air. They looked at the gold, and they looked at the U.S., and in one fell swoop, they dumped billions of U.S. dollars out of their reserves, dishoarding dollars, and bought down in just one transaction, 200 metric tons of gold for their central bank reserves. But
very
this is going on all over the world. It was last week that Russia said, it was unthinkable, Russia said, we're diversifying now out of the U.S. dollar as our reserve, and we have begun to buy Canadian dollars and Canadian securities as a way to diversify. But this is going all over the world. Central banks of the world had been sellers of gold all throughout this decade. From 2003 to 2008, the central banks had sold something like into the marketplace, sold something like, 425 tons a year, every year.
Amazing.
Last year, they sold zero, and now they're becoming buyers. Because they want out of the dollars.
Yeah.
They see this coming. The world has gone through these currency crises before. You know, a lot of these people are very sophisticated. They see it coming. They see the national debt in the United States. Look, Bush raised the national debt ceiling 7 times.
And a lot of that was the war machine, the Pentagon.
Of course it was.
The budget cannot be touched, and it's not just in terms of people. Death and destruction also that isn't even tabulated. The men and women coming home, they're injured, the lost talents,
you don't even get any accounting of the real cost of the war if you look at the budget. Not only do they hide the cost of the war off budget, they hide
the
it off
budget,
but there's
the budget.
All the subsequent costs, the cost to families, the cost of people who will need medical care their entire lives, the people who need psychological treatment, all of their... we don't even begin to reckon the destructive costs of the war, just in monetary terms, much less in more important human terms. It's an unbelievable situation.
It really is, and you've very well explained to us the cause of the meltdown and just what's ahead for us.
Well...
And what I was listening this morning to the radio, and I guess our financial leaders are now meeting in Davos, Switzerland, and there's kind of a divide between the fourth world nations and the first world nations. And it kind of broke down to me in terms of ethics and morality. They're seeing the lack of responsibility or accountability that we have towards honoring our debts.
The fantastic thing that we have right now is 305 million Americans that really don't know what's going on.
Yeah.
But the rest of the world knows what's going on.
I know.
Yes. You know, that is a very good point.
Isn't that fantastic?
Let me give you an example. When my book, The Dollar Meltdown, came out in November, within weeks, the largest publishing company in China purchased the rights to publish it in China. They are very aware. You know, it reminds
China.
Me.
They know
China.
What's coming.
It reminds me of that Zen story that you know, you take the fish out of water and you ask them to describe water, and the fish says, well, I don't know what you're talking about, water. You know, it's in it, around it all the time. It's not distinct in or distinguished in the consciousness of the fish because it's ever-present reality, right?
Right.
It's the same with the American people. Yes, the Chinese have a very good idea. They're keeping a close eye because they have a huge investment of dollars. But the American people, have no idea. Let me give you a better example. Timothy Geithner testifies yesterday, the Secretary of the Treasury. The clueless Secretary of the Treasury testifies about this AIG business yesterday.
Yes.
Let me back up and tell you, though. Let
Hang
me tell you what happened. Geithner goes to China And he speaks at Beijing University to a bunch of students there, graduate students, and he makes absurd representations about the stability or the long-term value of the dollar,
this,
as he does all the time.
Mm-hmm.
But they laughed at him.
Yes, I remember.
They laughed out loud. Now, he comes to the United States and he makes equally absurd statements.
And they clap.
You know,
and they show it on Fox.
People have no idea what's going on. So you're right. We have 305 million people.
Mm-hmm.
But look, the American people, I've spent a career in the media blaming all of this stuff on the elected officials, the governing classes, and so on. But I can tell you, the American people have got to shoulder a lot of the blame. They have been willing to accept these lies for all of this time, unquestioned.
Yeah.
They have believed things, so help me, they have believed things that a 12-year-old child wouldn't believe. When I was a 12-year-old child, when I was a kid and growing up in Flagstaff, Arizona, I would take my bicycle to the Shell station down the street. If I pumped the rear tire up, I had a low tire, and I pumped it up, blew too much air into it, overinflated it, and popped it, I would not have thought as a 12-year-old that I could fix it by just blowing more air back into it.
That's
what
I love
these
your
guys
analogies.
Have, they persuade the people, oh, no, we're going to blow this credit bubble back up by taking more money from you.
Yes.
And how about this? Uh-huh. How about the idea that we could spend our way to prosperity?
Now, kids
won't believe that. How about the idea, this is one of the biggest
shop
myths of all,
and
it's the governing classes who have been propagating these things. How about this idea? How about the idea that Americans, some of the richest people ever on the face of the earth, can continually go along this path of letting the government spend on empire and all of its other out-of-control appetite, spend with this voracious appetite for money, and do so by borrowing from some of the poorest people on the planet.
That's true.
How long can that go on? Mm-hmm. Because I'm here to tell you that the monetary authorities, the Federal Reserve, the fiscal authorities, Congress, except for inflating, except for running the printing presses effectively, they have no contingency whatsoever to fund their indebtedness when the Chinese begin to back away from the table. So who's to blame for accepting all these childish myths, for slumbering through this period and listening to these people who tell you that these things that a child wouldn't believe, that we could spend our way to prosperity, or that money can be created out of thin air, or that you could continually borrow from some of the poorest people in the world and this is going to go on forever. I mean, who's responsible for believing these things?
Mm-hmm.
You know, the American people are, well, you know, it's a day of reckoning. It's a day of accounting.
Oh, sure,
and nature has a very severe way of dealing with people who believe things that are not true.
Yeah.
And there were, although, how do we prime the pump, so to speak? How do we stimulate it? The economy. I've heard the other side too, that we need to start spending to create jobs.
Well, I'll tell you.
What can you say about that?
That's what they want you to do, because they want you to spend to create jobs, because there's an election right around the corner. There's another election in 6 or 8 months, and they want the numbers to look good. But jobs are created by capital, and the American people are trying to do the right thing. They've had an excess of debt, an excess of consumption. They've gone crazy with McMansions and flat-screen TVs and consumption and, every night out for dinner with a $250 bottle of wine. Americans have gone crazy in buying automobiles and fancy wheels for it, extending, taking money out on their credit card, taking second mortgage. Americans have had a consumption excess out of proportion to their real means.
Mm-hmm.
So what are the American people trying to do now in the face of the reality? They're trying to save. And yet the government comes out there and foils their instinct to save. You've got to have savings. If you have a bubble because of an excess of credit, you don't need more credit. It's like a junkie. You need another fix. No, you need to dry out. And so the American people realize that, and they're cutting back, and they see, you know, their neighbors and their friends losing their job, and they think instead of buying more, spending more, I need to create some savings. I need to have savings. What if my spouse loses his or her job? What if this happens? They need to save money. So what does the Federal Reserve do? They artificially lower interest rates to liquefy the banks, but it costs the American people who now have no incentive return for their savings.
They are confounding
the wholesome instinct of people to make up for their prior recklessness and now start saving. But it takes savings, it takes capital to create jobs, to create investment, to create opportunities, to hire people and so on. Yet this has been going on, I mean, since Nixon or probably before. Oh no, spend, make the economy look good for the next couple of months because we've got an election. And at some point, you know, the reason the Chinese economy has been growing at 10% a year for the last 30 years, the reason why when I was a little kid you saw people walking on the streets of Beijing and the newsreels showed them the streets teeming with bicycles and water buffaloes, and then it showed motor scooters, and now in the last month they have surpassed the United States as producers of automobiles. The reason the Chinese economy is growing at 10% a year and the United States not so much is because they are saving. And we are not saving.
And that's really an insane kind of a system if you think about it. The driving factor with that is that two-thirds of our economy is consumer spending.
Yeah. Well,
you get stuck in that as an American. You're almost stuck in this vicious circle. Because you want to have your 401k, your 201k go back to a 401k, you know, and so but there's really nowhere to stick your money.
Even worse is this brings up the morality plan.
So you have no way out of it.
Think about this, that we are so crazed on spending, and the centralizing authorities are so encouraging of spending, and they spend them. I mean, I sometimes wonder if these people don't drive by the playgrounds of America and the parks, and they look at the little kids out there on the teeter-totters and the merry-go-rounds and the swings and look at them and laugh because they are burdening these little children with debts grievous to be born that they will never be able
to make a few of them rich here and there. And
it's
not really that many people got that rich
they don't
off
have
the
a
meltdown.
Chance.
But they didn't
they really
care.
Don't.
Yeah.
And the debts will not be absolved.
It really tells you something about the fundamental decency of the country, I think. If you know that we can do this, we can load the little, you know, people talk, little children, they're precious, they're dear, and we're going to leave you indebted to $1.5 million apiece.
Yes, I mean,
it's just unbelievable.
I know.
Well, and that really is the crux of the thing. The whole thing doesn't work unless we have that spending. And so we've set up this system that just fundamentally doesn't work. The thing that
nothing tangible or manufactured anymore. There's
yes,
nothing.
That's a very good point. That's like derivatives. It's 600
what?
Trillion.
Can you explain derivatives?
Oh, I'm sure that you know what those are. Probably, I'm sure. But
I don't.
But it's derivatives. What is all of the money that's derived out of the current system? And it's $689 trillion, which is 10 times the world GDP. If that sounds right to you. So that was part of credit default swaps and all
paper.
That toxic debt. The swaps were being between 60 and 120 trillion credit default swaps. And so what's fascinating to me about the whole time when we were building up all of this, you know, we had this big quote unquote boom during the Bush years. When he came into office, he had a surplus in the deficit. And in just those 8 years, he took that $5 trillion in debt to $10 trillion in debt for really almost nothing. Prescription.
Yes, he did. He took it to over 11, actually.
Over
11. By the time he walked
out the door. And really for almost no reason. By massive spending cuts, getting rid of pay as you go, massive spending cuts, and things that were politically fantastic for him to make sure that, you know, he would look wonderful and his party would look wonderful forever. And completely screwed us all together. And then at the same time, we were building a system, an entire financial system, including that $689 trillion in toxic stuff that we're talking about, really. We built that on the idea that housing prices would never go down. in the models, do you ever have you run across that point? That's the one that blows my mind. The models that they were using mathematically to create derivatives were built on the idea that housing prices would never go down. Now, I have to say, I was just a silly little real estate agent in a teeny little podunk town, but every Monday morning we looked at that bubble and tried to figure out when it was going to pop for years.
You knew what it was.
We knew it was pop. Everybody knew that.
I didn't. How naive.
So how could they be the brightest men in the room? We're all being fooled, man.
Well, of course we are.
There you go.
Of course we are. I mean, we know them by the fruits of what they've done.
There you go. That's how you tell the tree.
Yeah.
By its fruit.
And isn't it the case, though, isn't it the case that the real brightest people, the people who at least have a track record, once again, of being Cassandras and telling us how it's going to unfold and what's going to happen and why, are not invited into the conferences and the halls of power?
In fact, they're considered suspect and paranoid conspiracy theorists. And
And we really probably sit around and think about, how do they get away with this? And I've come up with this idea. It really is key on the media. Because the democracy is only going to be as good as the information that people have. And for us today in 2010, that's bad news. Bad news.
I'll tell you something. I'm going to disagree with you a little bit there.
Give me your point.
I think that was true in the past, but I have more information available to me than any time in my life.
Mm-hmm.
I can ferret out the truth.
Really quickly.
Yeah. Of course.
Really fast. You know, I completely agree with you.
When I was growing up, it was, you know, three or four news services, a couple of television networks, a few publishing monopolies, and so on. But the people need to avail themselves of it. They cannot continue
absolutely.
To be in this slumber.
Completely well said.
I can see both points here. I think many, though, just watch the mainstream media
still, they
and they don't have the time or the inclination to scratch under the surface and look at alternative news.
And that's why I say nature has a way of providing a wake-up call.
There you go.
We're going to go through a very, very tough period, and people are now going to have to scratch their head and say, what happened? How did we get here? What was going on while I was watching American Idol?
Exactly. You know, for me, the story that's out there right now that really testifies to that is the story that the lack of regulation by Democrats of Fannie and Freddie was the cause of the economic meltdown. And that's a really popular attitude, and, you know, it's well held in certain areas.
Yeah.
And there definitely was, you know, there was a story there, but it's a different story. And all you really have to do is take maybe 10 minutes and put that in your search engine, and you'll find out some different facts that are never actually included in the news. For instance, in 2000, and I think it was four, when I think it was the Oxley bill or whatever bill they were using to try to potentially regulate Fannie and Freddie, Bush had actually asked for the percentage of loans to be raised, or purchases, I should say, because they only purchase loans, the purchases to be raised from 50% to 57%. So actually, the Bush administration was trying to up the amount of loans being loaned out to Fannie and Freddie. But that particular point, you never, ever, 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 ever hear.
No.
You hear this little gloss over story that it's because of poor people, and it's because of Barney Frank, and that's it. And most people really hold that idea. The difficulty with that is the more of us that hold that idea, the less chance we have of actually putting our finger on what actually happened. And we have to do that if it's not going to happen again.
Yeah, we
are in complete agreement about that. As long as people are poisoned by their partisanship, they're never going to get it.
And we're going to
And the Republicans, need to learn to. I mean, it's, you know, isn't there a line in the Bible where Jesus says, "So you love your own kids? So what? You know, even the worst barbarians love their own kids." It's take the beam out of your own eye, and then you can see clearly. So the Republicans have to learn to judge Republicans with the severity that they want to fault the shortcomings of Democrats.
Mm-hmm.
And Democrats need to learn to clean up their own act with the same standards that they apply to Republicans. But as long as it's this partisan nonsense of Republicans let all kinds of malfeasance and the corruption go on in their party, but they're quick to jump on the faux pas of the Democrats. And the Democrats do the same thing.
Sure.
They do not want to hold members of their own party accountable for their misdeeds, but they want to jump on the other party. And as long as people are willing to be poisoned by this partisanship, then America's, you know, we're never going to redeem a politics in America.
And this partisanship is poisoning us, our land, and the very air and the water we breathe due to the corporate power. But we're going to have to go pretty soon. And one thing I wanted to ask you, I'm going to have someone on later this month who's interested in creating a currency strictly for Santa Cruz.
Wow.
That we use. Certain businesses have that agreement. What do you think of that idea? Do you think that's the way to go?
Well,
I mean, locally.
I'll say this. I think anybody that wants to do that should be free to do that. If their currency, we have legal tender laws in this country, and the courts in this country will not enforce contracts that are denominated in something other than U.S. dollars the way they will, dollar-denominated contracts, because of the legal tender laws. My point on this is simply this. If the currency is of self-evident value, if the currency is good, if it's a true currency of self-evident value, you do not need legal tender laws to force people to use it.
So it'd be an agreed upon.
If the currency is corrupt, if the currency is being devalued or destroyed, if the monetary system is being plundered behind closed doors, then you need legal tender laws to force people to use it. Otherwise, they'll abandon it. So I say get rid of the legal tender laws and let the best systems or alternatives rise to the top, and you will soon discover that just as people for thousands of years have found that reliable forms of money are forms of money that are not dependent on centralized monetary authorities, then we will once again restore a wholesome monetary system.
I suspect, though, that we're heading in the other direction, where we're going to have
sure
a more centralized
authority. That's what the dollar meltdown is all about, describing how these things unfold, because the world has gone through these before, and there are certain steps, certain orders these things go through, and how people can protect themselves and their families, how they can profit from it in the hopes that on the other side they can create something new.
Well said. We do have a lot of potential, don't we?
Yeah, oh yeah.
We do.
And you're right. Yeah. America's debt is a powder keg about to blow.
The book
is about ways to take care of yourself and your family. The information is invaluable.
Yes.
It's worth its weight in
Thank
gold.
You so
it's a big
much
yellow
for your work.
Book. You can't miss it. The Dollar Meltdown. And what is your website?
Yes, it's thedollarmeltdown.com is my
primary
website.
Very
good. I also have charlesgoyette.com.
And numerous articles that you've
written. Fantastic. We'll be looking you
up. I have a couple of fun articles about my experiences in the media opposing the war.
I know. I've read them. And then I was hoping to discuss them a bit, but we're running out of time.
Sure.
Just the factors that are involved in creating a war, the fear, the fear premium. Then the collectivism, and of course the deceit, and then you fine-tune the lies. You really look at our accountability, each individual.
We are complicit.
You must have just written that out.
Wow.
Very.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
It was brilliant. Oh,
yeah.
I have it here. Where is it now? Confessions, what was it called? Oh, dear.
It was Confessions of a Wartime Heretic.
There you go.
Yes. And then
a heretic. Isn't that amazing?
Yes. And then it is good for one to be free.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And how quickly war destroys that. And it's an opportunity for the government to clamp down on our liberties and consider most of us terrorists.
I have another one for both of you since you're on the radio, too.
Wonderful.
It's somewhere, somewhere on my website, charlesgoyette.com. I wrote one at the time called How to Lose Your Job in Talk Radio.
I saw that afterwards, and I hadn't printed it.
Wonderful. I hope the light really shines on all that still.
There
We've
was
got lots
so
of time.
Much to read, and I feel, again, like we just touched the surface here.
Oh, we'll have you back sometime.
There's so much to share. We should have you on monthly, Charles.
Oh, thank you for coming.
We've got to bring you to Santa Cruz.
Yeah.
Speak at the Civic.
Oh, I look forward to it.
Yeah, sun's out today.
Oh, how nice.
We've had
Any
a lot
time.
Of rain. Oh.
Well, thanks for sharing with us.
Well,
thank
you
so
much.
Good to talk to you.
Yes, and we'll schedule something again soon.
Sounds good.
All right.
Thanks.
Ciao.
Bye, Hope. Bye.
Ciao, ciao.
Bye, Cindy.
Bye-bye. Thank you.
Bye.
Great. That was Charles Goyette, and he is the author of Economic Meltdown, and also wrote numerous articles, Wartime Confessions of a Talk Radio Heretic, and many others. And please check out his website. And right now, we're going to hear from Wall Street. I can find it here. Actually, AIG, I believe, they bailed out the banks, didn't they? It was interesting.
Volunteers. The men, the children, the adolescents, whatever. Yeah, sorry.
Do you utilize a lot of volunteers, too?
Yeah, we do have a lot of volunteers. They come on a regular basis and volunteer for us. And
please enter the number you wish to dial.
Our organization works because of volunteers. We only have like 3 staff members, and everybody is a volunteer. So.
Phone calls, setting up appointments for talks.
Office work, data entry, and
events,
preparation of events, and all that. Volunteers
are. That's their minimum.
Free Radio Santa Cruz is a local pirate radio station broadcasting at 101.1 FM and online at www.freakradio.org. For the last 10 years, we've supported local music and local independent media. Thanks for listening.
That's their minimum. If, you know, they meet the requirements of parole.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
I mean, they don't have the authority to resentence somebody. Yeah, well, the judge gave you that sentence, gave you, you know, a 10-year minimum, but, you know, we ain't letting you out. You're going to stay here another 2, 3, 5 years.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, they don't have the authority. That's their minimum.
Sorry about that, folks. We had a mishmash of different, I don't know what, programs. But right now we're going to be listening to the beginnings of a video on Democracy School. And that's another form of working with the corporations and taking control over our rights and ways that different communities have done that by passing right-based ordinances. I'm going to start that now, and then we're going to be speaking with Shannon Biggs, and she works at Global Exchange and teaches Democracy School around California.
The biggest problem in this
Here
country
is
facing us today, at least what I call working class of people, is corporation rights versing our rights. They trump us every time.
We have many problems. We have, you know, biosludge, dumps, excess growth.
We had quite a gathering trying to fight yet one more hog farm. The contaminated water, the air pollution.
We call it unreasonable development, unreasonable sprawl.
Everybody knew that there were toxic waste dumps spread around these mountains.
Frustrating. You know, you work hard and try to have something nice, and along comes a development, and they just destroy it.
We don't seem to be able to make decisions about anything in this country. You know, majorities coming together within communities lack the authority to make the types of decisions that they need to make to build the types of communities they wanted to build. And so all we did with the Democracy Schools really was try to answer the question, why?
This area right over in here and the other, on the hill over there, is where the sludge was spread.
Sludge is anything that's flushed down the toilet, which they changed the name now to biosolids.
Both my sons walked this way to come home, walked right down, walked right by the fields every day.
And if you're smelling it, you're breathing it.
Everything was fine until our son got sick.
The doctor called us in and he said to us, we did his culture and it came back. And he sat us down and he said, it's staffed. I just knew he wasn't going to come home.
We actually heard the machine.
You could see it flatlining. Yeah. And I said to him, just let go, Danny. I said, just go.
And how to go up and tell my son.
He was 16 at the time.
They're 13 months apart, so I had to wake him up. I don't even know if he was sleeping. He was laying in bed. I wake him up and tell him, hey, your brother just died. Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah, that was dope.
An article was in a newspaper about sludge being applied to fields.
Within 2 years after finding out what killed him, they brought the suit, and the courts said, sorry, we're not even going to hear it.
You got to stop it. You know, your rights are being violated. You're being dumped on, literally being dumped on by your state government and your local government.
It's real people making real decisions to deposit crap on other people and kill them.
That's why the democracy schools are around, because people don't understand what their rights are. You get into the school and you go, wait a minute, I have a say in this.
In Pennsylvania, we have had two kids die after coming into contact with land-applied sewage sludge. One of those kids was Daniel Pennock. It's who this school is named after.
Every school, actually, is different from the previous one, not just because the configuration of people is different, but because we all keep evolving.
And the reason I came to try and get some of our control back in our hands, local control, take it away from Harrisburg and take it away from Washington, D.C.
What it is, corporate personhood, and why it isn't to our advantage?
I'm mainly concerned about the corporate power of the media system.
What is it we don't know about this country that prevents...
Good afternoon. This is Janae again, and we're starting our second hour from 3 to 4. And with me on the phone is Shannon Biggs. And she is the director of the local green economy program at Global Exchange, and she recently co-authored a book, Building the Green Economy, Success Stories from the Grassroots. And now her current work focuses on assisting communities confronted by corporate harms to enact binding laws that place the rights of communities and nature above the claimed legal rights of corporations. And after the recent last week's Supreme Court decision to allow corporations to fund political campaigns, this is really interesting. But we're going to be talking about it in relationship to our ordinance, the People Against Chemical Trespass. And with me today, co-hosting this hour, is Giselle. She'll be here for about a half an hour, as well as Hope. And then someone else will be coming in who's working very closely, calling in. Mary Graydon, she has a lot of information about this ordinance that we will pass, I'm sure. Just a moment, and I will get Shannon. Shannon, are you with us? Shannon? What happened to her? Shannon?
Again,
and this is Giselle.
I was here last week.
And let's see where Shannon is.
Hopefully, we're going to get Shannon, because Shannon's an incredible person that's really putting a lot of work to pass this ordinance. She's helped
Shannon?
Set up the actual wordage of it, and is a really good consultant. And we're going to get her on the air soon. We're in Santa Cruz, starting to really make a movement here to do something completely different, and it's already been done in the East Coast.
Hi, Shannon.
And in the East Coast, there's been a number of different people that have passed ordinances similar to what we're going to pass, and I'm so happy that Shannon is going to be on the air to talk about it, because she's been very active here. We're getting a busy signal now. Little technical difficulties. But this ordinance can be something we can really make a change for the difference here in Santa Cruz, because they are still planning to spray us, if you haven't already heard, for the light brown apple moth.
Hi, Shannon, are you with us? Shannon? How strange. Let me see. Shannon. Very interesting.
Oh, we'll keep trying.
What's happening to her?
Democracy is a challenge.
We just got to keep utilizing the airwaves, because they're so precious. And whoever's on the air, just want to ask you to support an ordinance to stop the spray, because it's our one chance to stop it. And we need people to write letters, and that can be done if you go to peopleagainstchemicaltrespass.org, and there will be a few copy letters that you can be writing to your city council members, because it's real crucial right now to do that in order to make this difference and pass this ordinance. We've been through a lot of fights. We've gone through the whole process of lawsuits. We can just keep going through lawsuits after lawsuits, and that's not what's going to really make a change, right? There's been a lot of different talk about, we get sued if we pass this ordinance. What will happen? The fact is that 123 towns have already passed an ordinance like this in the East Coast, as I said. Only six were challenged, and those were passed also. And these ordinances in the East Coast, they've stopped damage for whatever, like the sludge you just heard before this program, or all these damaging, harmful things that are being put on the communities. So this is like a grassroots movement, a countrywide movement to take back our rights and assert that we have rights. We have inalienable rights to our health and safety. And if we don't stand up now to do something about it, we're just saying, go ahead, do what you want to us, because they're planning on doing a lot of different chemicals on us. And this is going to be great, because I believe Shannon's on.
I think we've got Shannon on now. Shannon,
hi. Hi, I'm here, I think. Hi, everybody.
Hi, Shannon.
Uh-oh.
She just pushed another wrong button.
Well, you're still there, but the edge of the universe is also there.
Okay.
Oh, so now we're going to call God.
God is helping
maybe
us.
Maybe he'll pick up. Maybe he'll pick up and stop this brain, please.
Yeah. Oh, here we go. Yes. Yay.
Shannon. Oh, Shannon, you were doing so well, too.
Shannon, are you with us?
I am here.
Yay. Okay, great.
Yippee. Hi.
Yeah. Hi. Woo. Really appreciate all your work. On
Hi, Shannon, finally.
The Joy of Anarchy Radio.
Welcome to Free Radio. It's been quite an ordeal getting you on.
Yay, we're so glad you're here.
So happy that you're here with us.
Thank you. I'm thrilled to be on the show.
Yes. And
thanks for inviting me.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you for coming on. We learned so much at Democracy School, and could you begin by just giving us a little history about how Democracy School got started? And
sure. Well, the Democracy School is actually the product of the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund, where this work really started. And so this is really kind of the history of the Legal Defense Fund, which is to say that the work that they do as a public interest law firm in Pennsylvania began centering around a lot of communities that were faced with onslaughts from corporate agriculture, including unwanted toxic sludge. And in the process of helping these communities find a way to, you know, explaining to them what it is that that's standing in the way of them being able to make laws that actually protect the community, they discovered that they couldn't do that. That the law actually prevents them and gives corporations all these rights, privileges, and protections. And of course, we've been hearing a lot about corporate personhood, which is one of those ways that corporations invade communities and take over our legal space as well to be able to manage our own affairs locally. Along the way, the Democracy School came about really as it's actually pretty involved in terms of what all the mechanisms are and what the history of the work has been. So Democracy School was really a way of explaining historically how did we get to the place where, you know, how did we end up in a place where corporations are running this quote-unquote democracy? And so part of the work that we do in Democracy School, as you know, is we look historically at the history of this country and the founding, and how did we actually end up, how did corporations end up with the rights that they have, and what can we do about it, and what have past people's movements for rights, the abolitionist movement, the suffragettes, the civil rights struggles, what is it that they have done to be able to actually assert and get their rights put into law, which is really what this work is all about. We're about making and training communities to have to assert their rights, to be making decisions about what happens in the place where they live. Because we don't think anybody else should be able to tell communities that you're a sacrifice zone for this corporation. So that's really the history of Democracy School is really more or less the history of this work. And people started saying, well, why don't you put it all together in a book and teach it? And so we have.
And I attended that school along with Jazelle.
Yes, I did too. A lot of great information.
Yeah, and the historical information was phenomenal, learning about the Federalists and the Anti-Federalists and the fact that our county, our cities are actually corporations. Municipalities mm-hmm. are.
Yeah, and the CDFA is a corporation. Yes. Making, that's why they're getting this $10 million. And even just having that program enacted, they're getting the $10 million. Even if they don't start spraying, they're still getting that money. That's amazing. So,
and there was so much information
yeah.
that we learned. It was amazing. And also, I was shocked to learn that our minds are actually colonized in the ways in which they are. Because we accept the authority of the corporations, the regulatory process, not knowing that the, or realizing initially that the cards are stacked against us from the very beginning, as we've been learning here in Santa Cruz.
You had that direct experience in Santa Cruz with the pesticide issue, that's for sure. And I think that that's, it's a really...
With a light brown apple moth.
Yeah, with a light brown apple moth, you really... Absolutely. One of the things that we talk about in Democracy School and is borne out in all the communities, certainly, that contact us, reach out, and I should say I work with Global Exchange and do this work in California as Global Exchange in partnership with the Legal Defense Fund. It's really a question of, well, so we look at the history of where corporations get this power, and here we, you know, we believe we live in this democracy and that we have all these tools, and including the law, including regulatory law. We end up with things like decisions like the Supreme Court made the other day, which is clearly, the questions that we ask in Democracy School that come up as themes are, who decides... and if it's not the people who are affected by a policy, then we don't actually really live in a democracy. If somebody mm-hmm. else is making the decisions, mm-hmm. Then we don't really live in a democracy. And so we look at the regulatory laws, who writes the regulatory laws that we have to follow? So, for instance, around pesticides. Well, by and large, we look at the history and just from our own sort of common sense, The regulatory laws are generally written by the industry to be regulated. So mm-hmm. the work that even when we work within the law, we don't get what we really want. We can't. It's not the law. It wasn't really designed to regulate. We can't protect people and nature using regulatory law, because regulatory law only allows us to limit the harm. Doesn't actually allow us to say no to the harm. After 40-plus years of, let's say, environmental regulation, and we take a step back and we say, by every possible indication of planetary health mm-hmm. With the regulatory system, we're worse off than we were 40 years ago.
Yeah.
So what does that tell you about regulatory law? And is it really doing its job in terms of if its job is to protect people on the planet, it's doing not a great job.
No.
If its job is first and foremost to protect the industry to be regulated and to make the effects of their profit-making machine less harmful, then that's maybe we need to take a different look at what the law is for and what it's supposed to be doing.
Something I really liked, Shannon, in the Democracy School is you shared with us about how it's like at a slot machine, you know, they're going to let some activist groups win, you know, make 20%,
sure.
you said, so that, you know, we'll keep coming back and playing the game. Mm-hmm. I love that, because it is yeah. just a game, you know, it's rigged from the start, and the only mm-hmm. way we can do anything is to challenge the unjust law, which is what we're trying to really get going here now in Santa Cruz with the help of everybody who's listening. So please, please go to peopleagainstchemicaltrespass.org and get the information of what this ordinance is about, as we'll be talking more here, and really support it, because it's our one chance. Because even the CDFA says that even this light brown apple moth is just the beginning, because they are saying that there's other pest warranting of emergency eradication too, many of them. So it's like, you know, this is ordinance is our chance.
And it's a big industry. They want to spray us. They're being
of
paid
course.
To do that. The
There's a lot of money in the pesticide industry is huge. The ordinance that that Santa Cruz has really been the community and folks in Santa Cruz after being sprayed, after going through and really seeing, you know, we talk about, you know, how do you win and in the regulatory realm, and everybody would say, you know, yes, we've had some victories. And I don't know a single person activist who has worked in with regulatory law that hasn't had some kind of victory. But I think we have to reframe. You talk about being colonized in our thinking,
yes.
And that's really what we're talking about, which is to say, who decides what's less bad, and why is it about parts per million when the people of Santa Cruz, if you ask them what they really wanted, they don't want less parts per million. They didn't want to get sprayed, and
right.
And so this is really about, this ordinance is about saying we're no longer going to accept the fact that we're going to be the sacrifice zone for any industry. We're going to decide about pesticides and the spraying or however whatever kind of application it is, and it's not just about the light brown apple moss, because there's the next pest and the next pest, and the light brown apple moss is one in a long list. We had the medfly, we had the glassy-eyed sharpshooter, and if the CDFA is gearing up for a long line of pests after the light brown apple moss. This isn't going away, and so unless we want to be training the next generation of activists now on how to fight pesticide after pesticide after pesticide to try and protect our community.
As if we all have that kind of energy.
This ordinance says it's not really actually about that particular, it's not about the light brown apple moth. It's not even actually really about pesticides. The question, the central question and the question the ordinance answers is who decides whether we get sprayed or assaulted with massive doses of any kind of chemical pesticide? Is it we, the people, who have to get sprayed, or is it somebody else that makes the decision?
And
the ordinance says from now on, it's going to be we, the people, the residents of Santa Cruz, are going to decide what happens to us and the issue of pesticides in the place where we live.
Right. Isn't it about breaking unjust law to end this unconstitutional oppression? And we're putting this.
Yes.
Yeah, that's what.
Yes,
it
absolutely is. People say, "Well, how can you do that?" Is this legal to be able to? I think that's what goes back to that colonization.
Who's defining law here, though?
So good.
And we're starting to do that.
We're defining law. Mm-hmm. How do we do that? We write new laws by breaking unjust law. Right now, the law is not working for we the people, and we have to make it work for us. And that means challenging unjust law, which, breaking the law, challenging the law, writing new law.
But unless you challenge the law, you can't really write new law, and we'd be setting a precedent if we were sued.
We have to stand up to say that we have the right to decide, and that rights are inalienable. Rights are come by virtue of being born. This isn't about, and the government is designed to uphold our rights. And if that's true, and if we live in a democracy, then we can change unjust law. We've done it in the past. Slavery was once legal. And if it weren't for, people who, stood up in all of the movements, the people's movements for rights, and actually broke Rosa Parks, who's, of course, one of our leading civil rights heroines, what is she known for? She's known for breaking the law, for civil disobedience, and that's in fact what the people of Santa Cruz are saying.
And I
we're
hope
tired.
Yeah,
mm-hmm. Yeah, Let's we're not going to allow somebody else no matter what you say, to take away our right.
And I hope, like every like Rosa Parks, all of us Santa Cruzans are tired of sitting in back of the democracy bus, and we're going to stand up and really pass this thing.
Well said.
That's what this ordinance actually says. And so, yes, is it edgy? Absolutely, it is.
The democracy bus has been the back of the democracy bus.
Oh, man.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. We get the back two seats, all 305 million of us.
This is
right,
hope
well, be careful
peace.
Because
She's
you're getting the exhaust back there.
Oh, gosh.
Okay.
That's why I'm fighting so hard.
Because we know the legislation has not stopped the harm.
No, and it's not going to. Because the legislation is you know, by the time it goes through the meat grinder of the process, they all end up looking like very corporate-friendly laws. And basically all we get are some crumbs, some concessions of what we want. And it's just not good enough. And it's not good enough for the residents of Santa Cruz anymore. That's what people are standing up to say. We're actually going to make the rules, and we're going to make new law by breaking unjust law, because there's really no authority. The government's supposed to be upholding our rights, and if it's not doing that job, then it's time to change the law.
And Santa Cruz is the beginning, right? We're setting precedent. The county, the other communities come after this.
There are, well, you haven't passed it yet, and there are, you're in a race in California.
Yay.
But, of
we
course,
are.
There are, this work is just beginning in California, and this has been happening for a number of years in a few other states, Pennsylvania, where this work really started, in Washington State, in New Hampshire, in Maine. In these states, there are communities, 125 and growing communities that have passed local laws that do just what yours are doing, which is to say we're actually going to, and on a variety of issues, from sludge to water withdrawal, and in Santa Cruz it's around pesticides, to say we're fed up and we're not going to take it anymore. Mount Shasta is also around water. They are passing an ordinance that that says no more water withdrawal from our aquifer, and it also says no to cloud seeding. They don't want to have toxic chemicals rained upon them through cloud seeding and have their weather manipulated and all kinds of other weather events that are associated with cloud seeding. And it's they've decided that this is the approach that they're going to take to assert their rights to decide as a community what their water future is going to look like, not any other water bottling company or PG&E's cloud seeding program. And in Nevada City, they're also looking at a sustainable watershed policy that's rights-based. And in Mendocino, they're looking at corporations and elections. And so this is something that's catching on in California. But we have Santa Cruz and Mount Shasta really working hard to be the first to actually pass one of these laws.
Can you tell us a little bit about the process that the communities in Pennsylvania went through, and what can we expect?
It's different in every community, and Santa Cruz, of course, is a larger municipality compared to some of those in rural Pennsylvania, where a lot of this work started. But I think what we're talking about, really, in terms of this, a lot of people say, "Oh, you're writing an ordinance. This is a legal strategy." And as you know, it's not. This is about an organizing strategy. And this takes place in every community. And part of what we're doing here on the radio, which is to say that the community has to be able to come together to say, we're going to assert our rights and our right to decide about X, whether it's sludge dumping in their community or pesticide spraying or water withdrawal. And to really understand the issue isn't about sludge. It isn't about pesticides. It is about who decides. And saying we're going to, the law doesn't work for us. We're going to challenge the law. We're going to write new law. We're going to be the ones to control our destiny. That has to be the frame for people, because We are writing a law. The reason it's not a legal strategy is because we are writing law that stands in the face of existing laws, existing regulatory laws that said we can't have it.
It does.
We deny corporations their rights and privileges that are guaranteed by the Constitution. So we're really talking about challenging some fundamental structural, the whole legal structure. And each one of these communities has decided to take on the whole structure, which means people have to be really committed to the idea that their rights are really theirs to have, and that they're not going to let anybody take them away. And that means being faced with the possibility that
it'll
not really happen, that there could be a lawsuit. And that's really the thing that frightens most the people in a lot of communities, is when everybody's on board with their rights, and then they go to the city council to pass the ordinance, and the city council says, wait a minute, this is going to get us sued. We're not going to pass it.
But that's part of the legal process that we just have to jump over. And
well, it's not just part of the legal process. It's about standing together. It's not about Rosa. Rosa Parks on her own, we wouldn't have heard of her if it hadn't been for all of the people that stood behind her.
That's right.
And made a really made a movement. And in this case, we're talking about communities coming together to force their city council to say, look, yes, we know what we're doing. We absolutely understand this is not a bulletproof. This is not a magic ordinance. The magic in the ordinance is really the people behind it that say, yes, we know that you have that we have a preemption law in the state of California. We know that corporations have these constitutional rights. They're unjust, and we're not going to follow laws that put corporations above we the people. And really convince the city council that yes, if there is a lawsuit, which is a big if, but if there is a lawsuit, we're going to stand behind you. We're going to stand behind this law because this is about our rights. And what are our rights worth? What's the dollar amount for Santa Cruz not to get sprayed, with pesticides? Mm-hmm. What's the price do you put on that? So it's really about looking at it in a different way.
Right, and we can't go on with business as usual because it's going to mean we're going to get treated again and again with more and more pesticides.
Mm-hmm.
So this is why this has to happen, and I just want
to
say again, people, please go to peopleagainstchemicaltrespass.org, get the information there, write your city council members because they need to know that we are behind this. And they need to have 100 letters.
Mm-hmm.
I talked with Don Lane. I sat down with the wonderful Mary and Ruth, who have who are the founders of this organization. They're doing incredible work. I really thank you both, and thank you, Elizabeth, who started
Quinn.
This whole thing. And they sat down with Catherine and Don. They need to hear from you. They are open, but they need to know we're backing them, guys. We've got to. This is a community thing. We've got to write the letters, and let them know. And the People Against Chemical Trespass.org will show you how to do that. And also, you can call this phone number, 831-425-3365, for more information. That's 831-425-3365. It's really important you get involved because, like Rosa Parks, it's not going to just be a couple of us. It's got to be all of you.
Mm-hmm.
So really,
and your videos as well.
Oh, right. If you want to, Shannon did an incredible lot of work. And last year they did a function where they were sharing all this. And I sat there and cried because it was like they were speaking so to my heart of what the corporations can get away with. And I sat there and cried. I had a camera in my hand, and I was videoing it even. And there's a small clip of that. It's called Our Safety, Who Decides. It gives you a really good breakdown. And you can go to the YouTube channel or on YouTube.com, Jazzelle Music. I'm a musician too. It's J-A-Z-Z-E-L-L-E Music. And you can see that video and another video, It's Not Over, Guys, and it's that, yeah. That is the name of the video. It just got accepted in the Santa Cruz Film Festival.
And the one in the Watsonville.
Wonderful.
Regulatory process.
Wonderful.
Yeah, in the Watsonville, that's what it's about. It's about the It's Not Over was taken at when we did the environmental impact report, the public hearing for that, the Watsonville hearing, and we found out, you know, they're not listening. They told us what they were going to do. They're planning on doing
exactly.
A splat, and maybe you guys can talk about that. I have to leave now and talk about what they're planning to actually do.
Yeah.
And really,
yeah.
Guys, please help us do this, because it's going to take
was
all
already,
of us.
Yeah,
thank you.
The decision
Thanks,
had
Shannon.
Been made, and they were given the authority to set the parameters for the discussion.
Right on.
And many people had excellent points. They were given 2 minutes each, and it was
yes.
already a done deal by the CDFA. But you know a lot about that, Shannon. I know you do. And really the biggest threat is the illegal stuff that is being perpetuated by the chemical companies and the CDFA. That's the real danger. They're empowered to do everything legally every day in our communities. That's what we're halting. It's simple. Go ahead, Hope.
Well, we either have a democracy or we don't. I mean, from the time we're little kids that they raise us and teach us in school, we have a democracy. And then we grow up and realize we don't. That whole thing was a whole fib.
Yeah.
And so if we don't have a democracy, what do we have? I mean, there's no really label. I guess some people call it fascism or something, you know, scary like that. But we don't have a democracy.
No.
We don't.
In the corporate.
Well, we're just going to create one. We're
yes,
pretend
we are.
Yes, we
have
are.
So much potential. That's our line for the day. We have so much potential.
Yes, we do.
We have our governmental system on our side because
time.
We really are the power. We really are the power.
Yeah, the corporations have wielded the law over our communities and endangering our health, our safety, our environment, everything that we
Not
stand
my
for,
kids.
Our very lives.
Yeah.
And this is a way to put a halt to it.
Fantastic. Do you feel like you get enough media coverage? How has that been for you?
Are you talking to me?
Yeah.
Okay. Media coverage, you know, media coverage is, you know, it's a double-edged sword. As you know, when you get an opportunity to talk on a program like this and you have time to actually really delve into the issues, because this is, you know, on the one hand, it's really simple, as you sort of put it. We have a democracy or don't we? Who should decide? Those sorts of things. But to really, you know, lay it down, and with any kind of depth, takes some time. And our media, especially our mainstream media, which is corporate media, isn't really geared for that.
Mm-hmm.
So, and would we want that? Would, you know, do we want to be on Fox News every night? I don't know.
Oh, gosh, no. How about
Fox.
Yeah. Oh, gosh, no. Fox News.
But, you know, I think
Fix
with
the
any,
ballot.
Anybody could say
How about locally?
Locally, I think ultimately that's really the battleground in terms of messaging.
Sure.
I don't really care so much about the New York Times. That's nice, whatever. But in op-eds and being able to put things out on local radio and community radio and the local newspapers, that's really valuable and important. In really being able to get this message out and to really have the discussion and to spark the debate in all the communities. So I would say in terms of local media, no, we need more.
Mm-hmm. We do.
Okay.
You know, every radio program
sure.
In Santa Cruz should be talking about the right to decide.
This is a big fundamental question for
it
our
is.
Community. And Santa Cruz is a wonderful community to be asking this question in.
Yes.
And so hopefully that'll work.
Yes. And
yes.
Shannon, isn't there a state law that says we can't make local laws governing pesticides? Is it a preemption law?
Yeah, absolutely.
Can you say a little bit about that?
Well, sure. So the California state legislature has determined that communities shouldn't get to decide for themselves what happens in the realm of pesticides that they know best. And
wow.
of course. They know best over, you know, with the influence of corporate agriculture. You know, I mean, where's all this the impetus for all this spraying coming from? And we can, you know, certainly follow that trail. But the fact is that yes, we have a state law that bans communities from writing laws that around pesticides, which wow. is very undemocratic, and it basically says that the state decides, you know, what's best for Santa Cruz, and in their infinite wisdom, they decided, you know, that the to spray for the light brown apple moth, and that they're going to continue to be applying pesticides in a variety of ways from here on out to meet very different objectives than you might in Santa Cruz use yeah. to decide whether or not you want to be pesticide laden. So yes, one of the many laws that we're actually frontally challenging is preemption law.
Mm-hmm.
Whose decision was that? Nobody asked me, and nobody asked Santa Cruz if the legislature would be the best place to decide what happens in Santa Cruz around pesticides. So it's one of the things that this law frontally challenges. It confronts the state to say the state is beyond its authority to decide what happens to the residents of Santa Cruz. The federal government is actually beyond its authority to say that corporations are people who can come in and make decisions and override what communities want.
And then my question is, who are the people that are in the corporations being shielded by the actions of the corporations? Who they're individuals, and they're not being held accountable.
Right. I mean, that's part of the beauty of the way the corporation is built. It is a shield for activities. I mean, the real people make decisions, and those people are protected. So, as we talk about corporations are not persons under the law, it's a ridiculous notion. They never die. They never pay taxes.
Right.
They have freedom of speech. Pretty soon they're going to be able to marry. I'm telling you. That's
thing. I don't know. That's a scary thought. Actually, they do marry.
They might.
They do. They merge.
They merge and all kinds of stuff. So,
says we decide. We're the ones that are being empowered. We then make the decisions ourselves.
Right.
And that's what's so important over our health, our bodies,
and it's not the illegal. It's not the illegal stuff that happens every day that corporations do illegally. It's the legal stuff, as Santa Cruz knows well. The spraying that happened was absolutely legal, but it was wrong. And nobody else should decide for Santa Cruz what is the value of your health, safety, and welfare when it comes to pesticides. Who else should make that decision but the people of Santa Cruz? And I think that's something that all the residents can agree on, whether they, you may disagree on this pesticide, that pesticide, how much, how little, but it should be your discussion, not anybody mm-hmm. else's.
Right.
It should be something that the people of Santa Cruz decide what happens to them, not somebody else.
Is there one citizen here who really wants to be sprayed?
I don't know.
How much real support for that? How much real support do people have for that? Yes, we will give up our health for corporate income,
sure.
profit.
Right.
Have your lungs impacted?
Yeah, that's the when we turn it into a question of who decides, instead of, before it was a question of, well, how toxic is it and parts per million and is it really dangerous? And
yes.
We get very sidetracked into very technical data. We all suddenly have to become experts on parts per million of chemical compounds and inert ingredients and active ingredients and all that kind of stuff. When really, if you just change the question to say, do the citizens of Santa Cruz want to be sprayed with pesticides for the light brown apple moth? No, we don't.
Absolutely.
I think that's a pretty
resounding no.
Yeah, it's a pretty easy question. And it really shouldn't be, the question shouldn't be a matter of, of course nobody wants to get sprayed. What is, to what lengths will we go to assert our right not to be sprayed? Mm-hmm. And the residents of Santa Cruz, in passing this ordinance, have said, we're willing to defend our rights all the way. And yes, we're willing to challenge unjust law. And in so doing, we stand with these other communities and a growing number of communities that are also doing the same. And as we stand together we will change mm-hmm. unjust law.
Mm-hmm.
And taking the risk, yes, the risk of a lawsuit, that's always possible.
That sets a precedent for the rest of the state.
In the nation.
This is really about, we set up a local precedent, sure, but which is then can be challenged. It can be challenged. And I think when we see, like, the Citizens United case, we see that the whole system is really set up to favor corporations. Mm-hmm. But the more we stand together and not just ask for, you know, signing a petition, this is the real deal. This is really saying, We're not asking for our rights. We're just going to assert them because we have them, and nobody can take them away from us.
Unalienable rights,
right?
Inalienable rights.
Unalienable rights. They cannot be alienated from us.
Right. They can be denied, and the preemption law is an attempt to deny the residents of Santa Cruz the right to make this decision, it's an unjust. It's an unjust law, and
probably written
by
corporate attorneys,
and it has succeeded in the past.
Where they are absolved of any responsibility, and with this mm-hmm. ordinance, we're taking back our democracy, where we're not forced to breathe poisonous pesticides.
Oh my God!
And to experience their impact, and it just goes on. And if we allow this, what do we allow next? We're taking control. We're changing the parameters of the discussion.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
It's
make brave, and the women of PACT, I just want to support the women of PACT, the People Against Chemical Trespass, who have been, this is a long struggle to get this new framework around the issue of pesticides in Santa Cruz, and they've been so steady
Quinn,
so steadfast.
You go, girls.
And for some reason, they're unable to call in right now, and I don't know why. Sometimes we can only be on one line. I'm not sure what's happening because
Mary
wanted to
enter. Dealing with the ethers out there.
The discussion.
I want to just support them and also just to say, yes, please go to the website, peopleagainstchemicaltrespass.org, and support the ordinance by writing. If they were on the phone, I know they would say to write letters, phone, fax, bug
show up at the city council hearing at City Hall. And if you go to the website, you'll get information on upcoming council meetings and what else you can do. City council contact addresses as well. You can write letters, and you can just show up and let the council members know that mm-hmm. you do care. You do not want to be sprayed. You do not mm-hmm. want to be poisoned.
And let me just say, democracy is a thrill. It's wonderful to get out there. And if you show up and stand up for your rights when you're driving home, you feel great.
Yes,
go out and spend $200 on a dinner and you're going to go home feeling drowsy and funky. Go out and stand up for your rights and you are going to go home feeling energized and knowing what you're here for. And you're going to have a big smile on your face, and you're going to keep fighting and making sure that, you know, our kids are protected, that they're not sitting in radio booths in 60 years. Can you imagine what corporations are going to be doing by then if we don't stop them by now? We have to do this now. This is for now. Yeah?
It's a new era.
It's really so exciting. We have so much potential.
We have so much work to do.
That's true, too. That's very true.
And
we're so glad that you're helping us with it.
It's my thrill, actually, that I'm happy to help. But the real heroes are the people who are willing to stand up in their communities and say no to us, to the whole system. We're going to do things differently.
Wow.
You certainly gave us a jump start.
Well, the founding fathers really did give us a lot to work with.
They did.
You know, even, you know, this much, however many years we are later, we have a lot to work with. We have a lot of, you know, a lot of good. Democracy is a fantastic idea. And we're just hoping we can have it at some point. You know?
Yes. Yeah, it's better than a good meal.
There you go.
Trust
yes.
people.
I completely agree.
We haven't really tasted it yet, but we're about to, Santa Cruz is about ready to sink their teeth into it.
Yeah, that's a fantastic thing to pass on to our kids.
Yeah.
There you go.
Yes, democracy would be a fantastic thing to pass
wouldn't
on to your
be?
Kids.
It would be. I'm excited.
I'm going to play a little jingle, There Ain't No Moss on Me, and see if we can get Mary on here to share with you, Shannon.
Very good.
We keep talking with her.
Okay.
So let's see if we can get this on one moment here.
Yay.
It's a great little jingle. Let's see. heard this? Here it goes.
Oh, here we go.
Oh, there ain't no moths on me. There ain't no moths on me. Why you wanna spray the places we play when there ain't no moths on me? Once upon a time there was a bug living alongside the birds and the bees. They called her the light brown apple moth, cause she liked to nibble fruit trees. Well, everything was going on just fine, there sure was no need to hate her. But then one day the CDFA decided to eradicate her. Oh, there ain't no moths on me. There ain't no moths on me. Why you wanna spray the places we play when there ain't no moths on me? This chemical they wanna spray, it's toxic and hasn't been tested. There isn't even proof it'll do the job. The moths might be unaffected. And what's gonna do to the rest of us? Our whole ecosystem's at stake. Hey there, Sack, you're ignoring the facts. Come on, give me a break. Oh, there ain't no moths on me. There ain't no moths on me. Why you wanna spray the places we play when there ain't no moths on me? Over there in New Zealand land, there's proof of the same solution. The moths and the people live in harmony, and no one's ever thought to nuke them. They lived down under for a century and haven't heard a single soul. We've got the same natural predators here, so what's all the rigmarole? Oh, there ain't no moths on me. There ain't no moths on me. Why you wanna spray places we can play when there ain't no moths on me? They're all obsessing on this little moth who's not even hurting our crops. But the politically motivated BM moth is who really must be stopped. Well, I got kids and you got kids and you know they've got some too. So why in the heck would they pass this dreck? It's all of us they screw. Oh, there ain't no moths on me. There ain't no moths on me. Why you wanna spray the places we play when there ain't no moths on me? Oh, there ain't no moths on me. There ain't no moths on me. Why you wanna spray the places we play when there ain't no moths on me?
Okay, I believe we have Mary Graydon on the phone. Mary, are you with us? Mary? This one isn't working. Mary. I can hear her. Mary, are you with us? Mary.
Yay.
Hi. She can't hear us.
Well, the song was... Well, we're working to get our guests back hooked up, but this has been a fantastic conversation. And I think we're really lucky here in Santa Cruz, particularly. There aren't a lot of cities in America. I'm sure there's a few. I'm really sure there's quite a few, but not that many, who could tackle an issue like that and really bring everyone together, because we're hopefully a little bit more awake here. We're really hoping. And these issues that are coming across our plate right now are fundamentally important to each and every one of us. And it's easy to go about our day and go to work, and we all have so many stresses and so many things on our mind. And, you know, in a way, that's really just what's being thrown at us to keep us off course. But if we just stop and think for a minute, we really do have the power, you know. we understand that we're maybe the missing piece, and we can come back and make a difference. So we're looking forward to doing that here in Santa Cruz. Woo! Let's see if we have some guests back on. That was a great conversation.
Hi, Mary.
Hi, Cynthia.
There you are. Yay. It was the other line. The other
I tried and I tried.
I know you did. I know. Something's going on with the other line. But I would like you to talk to us about what can happen if the ordinance doesn't pass.
Well, what can happen if the ordinance does not pass is that the state can go ahead and do exactly what they'd like to do, and that is to come in and finish up the LBAM program, which includes a number of pesticides that are not very good, even though they're saying that this BTK is an organic pesticide and it's used in organic farming. It is, but it's used very carefully. And so if they come into our yards, which is what they plan to do, and they spray this BTK, they spray it with hoses that goes 50 feet up, and they spray around the windows, they spray all the foliage in your yard, and by doing that, people are going to be inhaling it. And apparently during a neighborhood spraying, somebody would expect to inhale more BTK spores than would be consumed in a year's worth of food. And in New Zealand, they used BTK as an aerial spray, and hundreds of people were sickened. So on our website, if you haven't seen it, there is a video of this. It's ground spraying in Ojai, California, that they did last year. This is exactly what it would look like. Now, they were doing it for the gypsy moth, and Santa Cruz is also in the gypsy moth eradication area, so they could do that to us, too, for that, but it's what they plan to use for the light brown apple moth. And then the pesticide that really scares me is the pyrethrins. Pyrethrins?
Wow.
Well, they're pyrethrins or pyrethroids or permethrins. They're all in the same class. And they're going to be used in what's called splat. So they'd be in this gob of pheromone and pesticide. And they'd be shot up onto trees and telephone poles in our neighborhoods. And they say that they'd be shot up 8 feet high, so therefore there wouldn't be a problem.
Nice.
But when it rains or if they miss or it drifts down, it is going to be. And the thing about the pyrethrins is the CDFA is saying it's a common pesticide used around the house. It has been because it kind of replaced organophosphates, and for a long time they were thinking that the pyrethrins were a lot safer. But recently they've been doing a lot more research, and this Center for Public Integrity came out with an article on the fact that the number of reported human health problems, including severe reactions attributed to these pyrethrins, increased by about 300% over the past decade. So these are not safe anymore, or they've never been safe. It's just they're finding out that. And then there's the twist ties, 250 per acre, which I live on a quarter of an acre. That'd be about 60 in my yard. So these are all things that the EIR says, are not a problem, and they plan to come back in and they plan to do them. They're not going to be doing aerial spray over our homes, per se, but they plan to aerial spray over forested and non-urban areas where people live and work.
Yes.
And even the CDFA's researcher, their scientists, had to admit that there was at least a three-mile drift when they did the checkmate. So these are the things that are coming back for LBAM, and these are the same kinds of pesticides that they would be using to take care of the some 20 more pests that they have listed. They want to keep these programs going. They make millions of dollars.
They do.
So we have no money in this state, but we have money to poison our citizens.
Definitely.
Exactly.
We're broke, well, but we can poison people. This is high on the agenda. This is bullshit. We can say that on this station, can't we? That's bullshit. That's bullshit. Oh, that felt so darn good.
Well, you know, the EIR is being questioned by so many credible people. The county of Santa Cruz did a whole thing on it, and Senator Flores. And so, I mean, it's it's almost laughable that the CDFA is going to continue with their LBAM program because it seems to have been so discredited. But that's the thing about them. They just do it. They just don't pay any attention. As you saw at the video that you made, Jazelle, you know, they just sit there stone-faced, and they're just going to come back.
Collecting a paycheck.
Yeah.
Selling out democracy for money.
Yes.
Yeah. So
specifically right now, what are you doing to pass the ordinance, and how can we all help?
Well, we PACT people, which is all of us now. We're a much bigger group, but some of us have been meeting with... We met first with every city council member a couple of months ago.
Uh-huh.
And at that time, you know, they really didn't take us too seriously. Yes, we presented the ordinance and blah, blah. And so now we're meeting with them again. And so we've met with Mike Rotkin, Don Lane, Catherine Byers, and Tony today. So now we're really...
Tony Madrigal?
Yeah, Tony Madrigal. He's great.
He is. He's been supportive.
So we were, you know, just letting them know again and letting them know that what's going on, asking them what their questions and concerns are, and of course their main concern is being sued and there's no money. So, you know, we've been telling them that there are worse things than getting sued, of course, you know, giving up our inalienable rights and getting sprayed is, you know, much worse. They're politicians, so it's really going to take the people to push them.
Mm-hmm.
They're really going to have to get that behind them, because otherwise they're going to go, you know, they're going to go the route of, oh, we don't want to risk money that we don't have.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to, that's why we're really trying to get, we've got on our website sample letters, talking points. We need letters, emails,
mm-hmm.
phone calls, not so much is what we're finding out, because, because we've had several council members say that they really, it kind of just, they don't take them as seriously, although I think when we get closer and closer, it might be a good idea to just kind of barrage them with phone calls.
Yeah.
But at this point, they're really looking at letters. And the paper, the hard copy letters make the most impression.
Mm-hmm.
The problem with that is if you send a hard copy to the city council, it goes to the mayor.
Mm-hmm.
And it's at his discretion as to whether he wants to pass it on. It does go in the library, but that doesn't mean all the council members are going to see it. So either you have to send seven letters, or...
which is worth it.
Yeah, if
some
people aren't going to do that.
Oh.
But another way to do it is to email, because if you send an email to the city council or to the mayor, it automatically goes to all the council members.
Oh, fantastic. Mm-hmm.
So they do see it. So, I mean, wonderful. Those of us that can do it, it'd be best to do both.
Oh, wonderful.
And, Mary, right now I'm looking at the website, People Against Chemical Trespass PACT, P-A-C-T.
Yes.
It is loaded with information, and it's very clearly stated what you can do, what is happening. Easy, what you can do, show up, write letters, what the real problem is.
Yeah.
It's very clear.
And it's got
clearly outlined.
Who Decides video right there on the left. With it's great. That's such a great... We showed it to... You know, I don't think that the council members... I mean, you know, we tell them our website. I don't think any of them have looked at it, but we brought in the... the laptop the other day to Don, to show it to Don. And so we showed him a big part of that, and he... Ruth said his eyes really... You know, went right at it, because it is so powerful.
It is.
Fantastic.
You know, we wish they could all see it, but... Again, they're political, and they're going to try and figure out, you know, what they need to do. But we have to let them know that, you know, they have to pass it. There's no question. If the cost of not passing the ordinance
is too
high. Yeah,
it is. And there's also historical information on there, how corporations got more power than people. There's just, it's so rich with information, and how our minds have been colonized. I read about that last night after going to democracy school, and then learning more about that as well, I think, is on here.
Well, you know,
it's such a...
Something that's really important that we're finding out is that we have to let them know that we want this passed, but we also have to let them know, and Shannon mentioned this, and I guess I'm really realizing it, is that we're going to stand with them if they do get, if there is a suit.
Yes.
Because mm-hmm. that, if they were to decide to pass the ordinance, they did get sued, or we're not sure which way, who sues who,
yes.
then they would really not like to have to rescind the ordinance because of no money.
Yeah.
So we have to really let them know that by standing up mm-hmm. And making this statement, passing this ordinance, that that's what we want them to do.
Yeah.
We don't have the expectation that this is going to fix everything. You know, some of them even have kind of let us know that, well, you know, you're going to be disappointed if this doesn't, you know, fix mm-hmm. the problem. And we have to let them know that it's the standing up. It's the it's we want them to stand up for our health and our safety, and that's what yeah. we respect them for. And we have to see what happens after that.
Mary, very well said.
First step to democracy.
Yes.
What?
The first step to democracy.
Yeah.
Yes,
we're going to try to have democracy at some point.
Yeah.
We have another guest coming on at
Whoa.
4. We're going to learn about remineralization.
Oh, boy.
In our gardens and our land and the importance of that.
All right.
I think he's waiting. I think he's trying to get through. I don't know why. They're busy. There's something I need to learn about this further. Still a learning curve. But, Mary, thank you so much. I'm glad we were able to get you on. I was hoping to have you on with Shannon at the same time.
Yeah, well, that was you. I listened to most of you. You sounded great. Yeah. And thanks, Jezelle, too.
Oh,
yeah.
I will. She had to leave early. She had a board meeting.
Great work.
A
community
television.
Who's talking?
Who else?
That
yeah.
is Hope for Peace.
Oh, hey,
she's a very dear friend
of
mine, and she's co-hosting
hey
with me.
Oh, okay. Okay, well, thank you.
You'll have to meet her.
Thank you so much.
Okay, get those letters into the
yes.
city council, please.
Go democracy.
Yes, and who's the one that
People
said that,
Against Chemical Trespass.
Yeah. Who's the one that said that it feels mm-hmm. really good once
That
you
was
take,
me.
That was you.
That was Hope. You'll have to meet her.
It's true. It's very true. It's a rush. Democracy rush.
Yeah.
There's so many of us coming and going here today.
Yeah, it's a good
thing.
Hey, bless your day.
Thank you.
All right.
Yeah.
Thank
okay.
you
Thanks,
so
Cynthia.
Much, Mary. Thank
Bye.
You.
Ciao.
Bye-bye. Let's see. Now we're going to put on another song. This is It'll Stay, L Band. This is the original song. Enjoy.
And even when you're older
Good afternoon. This is still Tickling the Belly of the Beast from the heartland of Santa Cruz, and it's now 4, and we have another guest on. He's a very dear friend of mine, too. This is Randall Hopper, otherwise known as Grasshopper. Are you with us?
Yes, ma'am.
Yay! We've had trouble this afternoon with the phone. I don't need to go into it, but I'm so excited. Finally, and you have a degree in plant and soil science from Southern Illinois University in organic farming, and you're going to talk to us about remineralizing and what it is, and you've got so much enthusiasm and insight, and I know you've been talking to a lot of professors about it as well. You're at Lake Tahoe now, aren't you? You were supposed to be here.
Yes, ma'am.
Well, welcome, Randall.
Thank you.
Grasshopper. Wow. This
is
great.
It's such an honor. Yeah, my name is Randall Hopper, and I have a degree in plant and soil science, and I've been researching on using rock dust for soil remineralization and soil fertility, and I've been inspired from a lot of teachers and people in the field, a lot of actual farmers who are using rock dust to remineralize, to build up their soil fertility on their farms.
Now, how did this get started, using rock dust?
Well, the earth naturally has like a cycle that it will like cover certain areas with rock dust geologically.
Mm-hmm.
Glaciers have been known to crush rock and to pulverize them and disperse them through wind and water. And also just volcanoes themselves, they often emit clouds of rock dust, basalt rock dust, and that is full of lots of minerals that help the soil fertility in that area. So Earth has natural cycles of soil remineralization, and there are more current practices with, like, crushing rock now.
Mm-hmm.
And also crushing rock and using that as like a soil amendment. And it has some of the same natural properties.
Now, what are some of the benefits of remineralization?
Some of the benefits is like increased bacteria reproduction.
What?
It helps the beneficial microbes proliferate. So if you can imagine like someone trying to build a house and needing the supplies to build a house.
Mm-hmm.
So you develop the different kinds of stones to put it together. It's like the bacteria can utilize the nutrients inside of the rock dust to build structures for themselves, to like multiply. So it helps bacteria to multiply like 2 to 3 times more than averagely would in regular conditions.
And does it... I had read something about it increasing the nutrient intake of plants, too, and restores the soil pH.
Yes. When you have this proliferation of bacteria, it's creating, like, excretions, and it's digesting these minerals and making them more bioavailable.
Uh-huh.
So that when the roots congregate around the bacteria or where they're living, the plant can easily utilize some of their waste and like parts of the bacteria as like a symbiotic relationship.
Oh.
It helps make nutrients more available by the bacteria multiplying more and creating a bioavailable nutrient. They help break down the rock. And the rock itself has all these trace minerals. Like a full spectrum of trace minerals. And trace minerals are trace.
Uh-huh.
It's like very small amounts that we need. But we need a little bit of that just to function.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's like in the kind of rock dust that works the best, it's like the volcanic basalt. And there's different deposits, and the rock dust can differ from the different kinds of rocks that are crushed, because you can have a volcanic basalt, or there can be granite rock,
and each has its own geographical location and geological way it was created. So it has different levels of nutrients. So it's a very wide spectrum of rock types that can be used for rock dust. And some of the ones are actually better, can have a higher concentration of key minerals that mm-hmm. are in the trace minerals. So there's there are some deposits in areas where it is actually really concentrated nutrients, and that can help like the local farmers in their area. Mm-hmm. So it all depends on, it has a little bit to do with soil type, but uh-huh. with a lot of the cases, a lot of the research that has been done on farms is that they work to varying degrees, each of them does.
And now what, and when you say to varying degrees, what accounts for that?
Okay, sure. Like thousands of pounds on 1 acre.
Ah, of soil?
Yeah.
Or of rock dust? Oh, rock mm-hmm. dust on the soil.
Yes.
Like on a raised bed.
There's a huge drastic increase in fertility that happens when you introduce like a thousands of pounds on 1 acre.
Wow.
But there's like, you can start to, that will really like take, help the soil fertility to take a quantum leap. Because rock dust, it has like all these trace minerals that the bacteria love, and it helps to raise the production level of the soil.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And can you, how is that? What you said, rebalancing the soil pH. And
oh yeah, you'll just have it seems to neutralize things, but only because the bacteria just proliferate so much,
mm-hmm.
and because they have all the nutrients that they need to multiply, and that kind of can help balance the pH, especially depending on the microbes that are in the soil. Sometimes soils can be exhausted or more acidic,
mm-hmm.
and the acidity comes from the kind of bacteria that are in the soil. Sometimes there are acid-causing bacteria,
yes.
and more neutralizing bacteria, and in more acid conditions, it can balance out the microorganism so that there's more a beneficial microorganisms, beneficial bacteria. So the rock dust helps to benefit like the social bacteria.
What do you mean by that?
There's like it's a microflora that creates available nutrients. It's like, it forms like a symbiotic relationship. It's just that there's like this level of vibration that beneficial bacteria offer. When you have the organisms meeting all their needs,
mm-hmm.
they can reproduce really quickly,
mm-hmm.
and there's no there's not a lot of competition. But when nutrients do get starved, or that there's like a low population of bacteria,
yes.
it's kind of striving for these parts, striving for these nutrients. So sometimes,
I see.
Yeah, so it assists the foundational soil fertility of like the supporting their reproduction and like in their food source. So it gives the beneficial bacteria everything it needs to multiply.
So basically, and when we had talked after ceremony the other day, you said remineralization actually restores overall the ecological balance. And help stabilize the climate. And we
mm-hmm.
need that more than ever than
yeah.
sustainable agriculture today. It's mm-hmm. a major priority.
Yeah, we have like the hugest potential right now. We have all the systems in place that could support just rock minerals, because there's a huge aggregate industry and mining industry
yes.
that has lots of piles of aggregate fines.
and also other kinds of like rock powders.
Mm-hmm.
And there are more specific industries in the aggregate industry and mining industry that they have a focused understanding about remineralization. There's like a task force, and there's farmers who are using it on their land to grow a lot of food for the people.
And on their website, it's called Remineralize the Earth. And
mm-hmm.
you can just Google that. That's where I got some information when you took off for Tahoe.
mm-hmm.
I did a little bit of homework. And apparently there are a number of projects throughout the world.
All over the world.
Yes. Do you want to say a little bit about, do you know something about mm-hmm. the different, what do you want
yes.
to share about
yes,
the
I
different
do. There's
projects?
There's a Sphere Project, S-E-E-R. They're in Scotland. They're doing work with just growing
did
organic
you say Scotland?
Vegetables. There's work in Scotland.
Uh-huh.
And there's also some work here locally that's being done. That's what's the most amazing thing
in
is
Santa
that there's
farms
in Santa Cruz.
Tell
there's
us.
There's local farmers who are using this rock dust, who we eat from and support. There's a Pinnacle Farm run by Philip Foster, and they have some of the most amazing produce. And I usually get, we get some onions from them and some other things.
That's the Pinnacle Farm?
Yeah.
And where are they located?
Philip Foster? I thought it was in Watsonville.
Oh, it is local.
Yeah, it's like really local.
Do you know their phone number or how anyone can get a hold of them? And
Pinnacle Farm?
Pinnacle Farm.
Philip Foster.
Mm-hmm. Pinnacle Farm.
Mm-hmm.
Great.
He's a local farmer around here, and they use rock dust for their soil fertility.
Great. And it deters insects, too.
It just creates this whole like beneficial bacteria all the way up to like the life above it that supports the diversity of the plants and the insects.
Mm-hmm.
So you have this community that supported from the ground up, and a lot of it helps with the insects. The insects, the vibration will be higher. Insects naturally attract the plants that are on their way, you know, that aren't the strongest. But as the vibration rises, the insects that are beneficial to that area will be around the plant. That's what has been seen on some of the farms of the people who are using rock dust. Like the whole vibration is higher. And they, there's a word called paramagnetism.
And what does that mean? Paramagnetism.
Oh,
I am not. Soil scientist.
I feel like it means like the vibration, the resonancy of things that help it run at the most efficient state of being.
Oh, can you say a little bit more about that?
Like, there's this farmer who has these chickens.
Yes.
And his chickens are like really, like, have a lot of energy and they fly over the house. And the pig is like really friendly. He'll come up to the gate and welcome you to the farm.
Oh my! So it's a kind of a it impacts their emotions and their sense of safety.
I guess. It is the community. It's more of a community vibration from the ground up.
Oh,
and these rock people
amazing.
Really help. Yeah.
Wow.
Like the rock people are the oldest. They're like our grandparents.
Yeah, I know. This is ceremonial talk here, but it's true. The rocks are, and they do harbor a lot of information. They're the oldest, I guess you might call them beings or entities on the planet.
Mm-hmm. They say in Hawaii it's their grandparents, or the enlightened ones.
Yes. And there, oh, so that is that energy you're talking about. I understand.
Mm-hmm. They're like the, they're
so
like
that's
the foundation.
Vibration. The foundation. Yeah.
Yeah. And that has so much potential for like the world, because all the systems that are in place could benefit from using rock.
Mm-hmm.
Rock. Rock people. Rock dust. They call it rock dust. They call it rock powder or rock flour. Whatever it means to
rock powder, rock dust.
There's so many qualities to it.
Yeah, it's like a full spectrum. Like, I looked at the readout of some of them, and they have, like, gold. There's, like, little bits of gold in there, or silver, and then there's zinc, and some molybdenum, and some really good trace minerals that are in there. And the thing about it is that the glaciers will crush rock really fine, and you'll get this glacial water you'll see running up in the mountain. And the water is full of trace minerals that there's, like, some people up in the Hunzas or, like, somewhere up in the mountain, and they live to, like, 100 to 150. And a lot of it has to do with the water they drink. And it's full of minerals and hydrogen. So,
well, we're certainly lagging for minerals and, I mean, healthy soil.
Yeah. Ever since they started farming, I mean, there's been a little decrease in nutrients, and it's like really, it's like the trace minerals are really there for us. It's like a full spectrum of like our genetic potential to our genetic potential for expression. They notice that when you put this rock dust in the soil, it helps a lot of plants grow easier, so that they can yield more and taste better. It has a better genetic expression. And it's a lot of it has to do with the bacteria from the ground up.
Mm-hmm.
And creating that full spectrum of molecules. But the plants grow better and they're tastier.
Yeah. I think I've tasted some. And they also, I know so many trees are dying. We've heard about the sudden oak death to sudden oak life.
Yeah.
And they remineralize forests, I guess, have the potential to sequester as much as 4 times the carbon than unmineralized forests.
Correct.
That's fascinating. That was on our website last night.
The rock dust naturally sequesters CO2 in the form of carbon. Around, it's like all the molecules it creates, it's like it uses a lot of carbon. So when you have more bacteria underground, it uses up more carbon and it stores it in the soil as like the humus.
humus.
And that really helps with CO2 sequestration, so it can help in the larger picture for for climate stabilization.
Mm-hmm.
It's like using rock dust to help the bacteria proliferate, but it also helping the bacteria and helping the trees. In some areas, the pH of the soil has affected trees from pollution, and they have used rock dust to help balance the pH by help balancing the bacteria, and then it helps the trees to be even more breathing for us.
Well, that's how we breathe.
And it shows really great results when they're reforesting in areas. They use like a trace mineral blend of rock dust. It helps helps trees, especially to grow quicker. We've done research with eucalyptus trees. And people use it now with vineyards, out in the vineyards. And some vineyardists will put the rock dust on top because the worms will come up and just scoop the stuff into the holes because they can detect where the source is coming from.
Wow.
And they have a unique microflora in their system, in their stomach, that helps create, it's like the most perfect incubator for humus. That's why the worm castings grow some of the best tomatoes. Well, rock dust helps to supply, earthworms will search out rock dust to actually pull it into their little hole and munch on it.
Oh, my gosh. They know instinctively.
Yeah.
It's how.
And they're made in the plant, too. Like, there's a rose grower who studied using rock dust as, like, a foliar spray.
Yes.
And he was looking at the really tiny, in the microscope, of the leaf, and he could see the actual roses were sticking, like, these proboscis out of their stomates and pulling them into their holes of the leaves.
Wow.
So the plant has, like, some plants have natural abilities to
to pull in the rock dust through their leaves.
Amazing.
Like foliar feeding. And it creates this whole, like, aura around the place because everything has what it needs.
Mm-hmm.
It's like this great, if everything has what it needs, then everything could live in a more, everything can be more productive. So, yeah, like the plants are really, really, really respond to the rock dust. It's like the key part. It's like one of the most, like one of the most important parts of a soil fertility.
Sometimes you're going in and out on the cell phone. Can you just repeat that once more? I didn't hear what you said.
Sure. That rock dust is a primary catalyst,
uh-huh.
the driving force in building fertility. Strengthens the ecological the balance, and it helps to conserve water.
Oh, well, that's essential.
Yeah, a lot, like 25% of California could use less water by using rock dust because the bacteria would be able to multiply more and hold more water in.
Mm-hmm.
So it could really help with conservation.
There's so many properties that it has. And I was just reading, last night, at the application of silicate rock dust for the amelioration of forest soils, and it said long-term experiments released in 1986 in Europe showed that in a forest where pine seedlings were remineralized, after 24 years, the wood volume was 4 times higher than an untreated, and the application lasted for 60 years. I don't know why we're not using it more.
Yeah, it's like waiting in piles at some of these mining places. And
it returns the minerals to the soil, much mm-hmm. as the earth does. Glaciers, volcanoes.
Yeah, and like barely anybody's doing this on the planet right now. There's only like a selected few amount of people who have been, there's a lot of them are farmers. A lot of the farmers who just have been studying have actually been using this. And a lot of them are in this area of Santa Cruz. Like, if I could just mention Rick Knoll.
Sure.
He's a local farmer. I think he went to San Francisco. He has two farms out there, or he has a farm out there. They've been using rock dust out there. And they supply to some restaurants in the area or in San Francisco. And he says it works.
Wow.
There's, what's his name?
Have you worked with it much directly in the soil? How is it used? Is it sprayed on, or do you put it on with your hands? Do you get right in there?
Uh-huh. There's some farmers who will band it, who put it down in a band, and, there's some who will turn it in, like disc it in.
Hmm.
Some foliar feed it. And some will mix it in with a lot of compost. And it's like one of the best places to plant it. In the compost, it's like already all these bacteria there. So it helps balance out the pH of the compost. Helps, helps retain nitrogen, which is a huge thing because of the bacteria. We'll utilize all the nitrogen sources and contain it and process it. So it helps. So what some farmers will do, we'll make a really nice compost with the rock dust and then either make a tea with that to spray on the plants or spray in the soil.
Now, what are the medicinal benefits of the tea?
Well, the tea, the beneficial benefits is that it's just full of beneficial bacteria that it's like when you put it on, it just like coats everything with this like really, really rich bacterial source. So it's like really, it's like inoculating a whole area full of like beneficial bacteria and having it be the ones that you want to keep around that help sustain the health
of the area of the plant.
I just want anyone tuning in right now, you're listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz 101.1 FM, and we're speaking with Randall Hopper, otherwise known as Grasshopper, about soil remineralization and our climate as well. And also, how did you first learn about this remineralization?
There's a book called Secrets of the Soil.
Called what?
Called The Secrets of the Soil.
Secrets of the Soil.
It's by Peter Tompkins.
Tompkins,
I think.
Tompkins, all right.
And in it, they talk about the Hunza people and the water that comes out from the mountains, like a cloudy water. And part of it was the minerals in the water. The other part was the hydrogen. Lots of hydrogen helps the cells to retain it. It helps to retain water. Like makes water wetter, and the hydrogen is an important part in our cells because it's the key element that is ignited for energy. So it helps us to stay moist and energized. But the water and the minerals I first learned about when I was going to school to study plant and soil science, and then as I went my travels to California, I met a person named Bliss, who told me about this book called The Survival of Civilization. And one of the key discussions, I forget his name, the author was talking about...
What was the name once more? Survival of Civilizations?
Survival of the Civilization.
All right. And what...
They were talking about their findings into using rock dust as like to sequester CO2 from the air, to use to mineralize forests, to increase productivity, and they're saying that the rock dust was like the key ingredient, and that all the systems were in place to help it to remineralize the earth. And I learned about that book, studied up on the Remineralize the Earth website, found out some contacts, and then I met with the Regeneration Society, Earth Regeneration Society, and they're based out of San Francisco. And I got to know some of the producers.
Now, what's the Earth Regeneration Society?
Their group that I met, Alden Bryant, he's the founder, and they are concerned scientists who are interested in regenerating the earth so that we can be greener and healthier. So they have some information about remineralizing the earth through rock dust and then other topics about energy and healthcare.
But you've done your homework.
Yeah, I've gotten to know some of the people in the industry. There are already people who are producing this, and like the biggest thing to know is that it needs to be known by the general public that this is working. This works. This really helps the plants grow. It's the best investment right now for like growing really natural food. It is labeled as an organic fertilizer. So it has a huge potential for food security.
Food scarcity, yes, it does. Food security.
Security, because it's like the best investment. It's like the best investment in the world. It's like money in the bank, soil bank.
Yes, and with food shortages looming ahead, possibly, and already happening.
It's like the best investment. It really is.
It is. I'm like, just learning about it.
Like burying your money, like putting it in the soil.
And there's that website, Remineralize the Earth. And what are some of the projects presently?
With rock dust remineralization?
Yeah. Yes, rock dust from you. Tell me.
Right now it's being used by lots of farmers. There are farmers who are very open, who have done their homework, who are in the know, and who have talked with other farmers, and they're using it. And it's like just starting out here.
well, it's not just starting out here, but it's like a lot more farmers are using it here on the West Coast because they know it works. And
so
it's
growing. Where could someone go to get a list of those farmers and get involved?
With the farmers who are already using it?
Yes.
I
to
can
buy
just list,
some of
I,
their produce. And
oh, to buy some of their produce? Sure. Here's Bob Kennard. He lives in Sacramento.
Is there a website that has their names? Or
I don't think so. Unless they sign up. I know some of their names.
All right, share them now. Bob.
Philip. Bob Kennard. He lives in Sacramento.
Is that C-O-N-A-R-D?
I thought it was maybe K-A-N-A-R-D.
Would you have his phone number or web address?
No, I don't. I just know that he's just been using this for 10 years. He has 50 acres in Sacramento.
Mm-hmm.
They sell local produce to the folks out there. And there's Philip Foster, who lives more in this area. He's part of Pinnacle Farms.
Pinnacle Farms using, is our local.
Yeah. Philip Foster. He's been using Rochester for, I think, 8 years. And sells amazing produce. I usually get some of their produce at Wednesday's market in Santa Cruz.
Oh, you can get it. Can you get it at the farmer's market locally?
Yeah.
Oh, great. So on Wednesday afternoons at the local farmer's market.
These farms, some of these farmers have
Pinnacles.
The richest farms in the world.
I can believe
because
it.
Because they have some of the most fertile farms in the world.
Mm.
And it's a lot of what they do with the soil. A lot of what their work is. And they're some of the most amazing pioneers in the area of soil fertility.
Do you know
and
if they're
local
any...
here?
Aye. Do you know if there are any films or documentaries about soil remineralization?
Huh. Documentaries? No.
Maybe on the website, I'll remineralize the earth, and maybe there are links from there.
There are, yeah.
And then the books you want to recommend, that was Earth Regeneration by, who is that?
Survival of Civilization.
Survival of the Civilization, okay.
Or maybe Survival of Civilization. Handsome, amazing.
Just
and then,
its
like,
potential.
Yeah, and then in the 1800s, there's a German author, and he wrote Bread from Stone.
Bread and from Stone. Oh, I love that title.
Mm-hmm.
He was ahead of his time, or maybe not.
Yeah, it really helps wheat grow. It helps all the grasses grow. It helps the orchards grow. Helps everything grow.
And it's volcanic rock, too.
They use volcanic basalt, which, depending on where it is, what's the content, it can be really potent.
I'm sorry, what was that?
Volcanic basalt. It's like, the things about the rock dust is that there are some rock dust that are more, and have a higher concentration of nutrients.
So that's why it's so important.
That can work that 10 times better. So I'm starting to get to know people who are producing this stuff, but I'm trying to establish like a network of farmers who can help maintain soil fertility so we can have really good food for many generations.
We have to increase the organic matter in
our
soil.
And this is the best way.
What we're getting in the grocery stores is benign.
This is a huge, this is a huge driving force for building soil fertility.
Huge. What about biofuel? Is it used in that?
Well, it would dump. It could.
I don't
know. Yeah, it could.
I'm just thinking.
It could actually help the plants grow better. Like, if you wanted to make more biofuel, it could help those plants grow better. So they'd be more, you get more of a yield. They did a study on oils, they did a study on corn, and they grew more corn and other plants. It increases yield. They use, like, an azomite
there's like this stuff called azomite.
What's that?
It's like this trace mineral blend that has like from A to Z.
Mm-hmm.
It's like this pinkish clay that comes out of Nevada or somewhere, Utah. But it has like the full spectrum trace minerals too. And that helped a lot of plants grow better. And they use it as animal feed. Some folks feed it to animals. And they notice that it helps the bacterial flora so that there's more beneficial flora around.
So many benefits.
Yeah. That can even help the animals out. So they're,
yes.
they grow quicker and that they're healthier.
And those that eat meat are getting a healthier variety of meat.
Yeah, it helps. Like it helps in all situations. It can help balance the E. coli and like the feces, so that all of it can be like a really nice. So it can be really full of more beneficial bacteria.
And does it increase the growing time, or shorten it rather? Of plants and. If you're in a harsh climate, unlike ours.
I have the feeling that it can make more denser plants.
More what?
Denser.
Denser.
Like more of a cell structure.
Solid.
Yeah. Because it allows the plant to not have to work as much to maintain its like optimum health. So it has more time to create secondary metabolites or just like more sugars. Or more reserves, so helps the plants grow better for sure.
This is very timely. I'm surprised when you first started telling me about it. I was surprised that I didn't know much about it and hadn't heard of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's really
needs
recent.
To be spread.
And this is like a really like this is like really the cutting edge.
It really is.
And like I'm so glad that if anyone's listening that this is like huge, because a lot of local people are using it.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of farmers are using it and they're having success with it and they say it works. And that's like coming from our food source, and it's just a little it's public knowledge of our food, how it's grown.
Yeah.
And the huge potential it has for other places, too. Like all the other farmers, they have the potential to take a quantum leap in soil fertility.
Yes. I mean, sometimes your voice is fading in and out. It might be your cell phone. I'm not sure. I'm just going to see if we can improve that a little bit. And put on, what was the song you wanted me to play? Apache Sundance.
Or DNA Ascension.
I'll have to get that up. But I have this one here. We're just going to take a little music break here, and you're going to listen to Apache Sundance. That should be coming on.
Ho, Metakuyasi, all my relations.
Metakuyasi.
Yo, hey, 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 yo, hey Tagliati. Apache philosophy teaches us how to, one, understand the principles of nature, two, understand the principles of and motivations behind community structure, three, understand the principles that govern and motivate us as individuals, and four, understand the dynamic relationships between all that exists. Rock mineral dust has a really huge potential as like a prime catalyst for soil fertility. There's a lot of local farmers around here who are using it.
Around Santa Cruz.
And it's growing a lot of our food. And there's a huge potential for everyone to benefit from using it.
Yeah.
I'm a plant and soil scientist, and I'm trying to help increase the soil fertility in the Santa Cruz area and the world, the nation, the world. And I'm here to help be a bridge to resources for rock dust usage. I can leave everybody with my email address and phone number.
Please.
And it's Randall Hopper, Randall Lee Hopper. So it's RANDALLLEEHOPPER, Randall Lee Hopper at Gmail. And I have a Maui phone number because I substitute. And that's
in
area
Maui.
Code 808-344-0155. And I just know some really good sources for rock dust. And just want to get the word out that this stuff really works and that it's there for us.
Well, thank you. And your alias is Grasshopper.
Mm-hmm.
And I've attended various ceremonies with this young man, and he really does walk his talk. He knows the land, he knows the soil, and he knows the elements too, fire, wind, air, and earth. It's just he's one with the elements. I really enjoy knowing you. You're like my little brother, Grasshopper.
So I didn't know you. You remind me of my mom. You're like the same size as her.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
We have fun.
She's really a kind
fire.
Of heart, too.
We
just
have
feel like
a
we're all related.
And yes, we are.
I
really
feel
forward.
Like ancient ways. I mean, there's like so many.
What a singer
so
you are, too.
They're there for us. So.
Yeah. You have so
this
much to share. All right, well, thank you, Grasshopper, and welcome.
Mm-hmm.
When are you coming back to Santa Cruz?
Maybe in a week or two.
Good. I'll see you at the drum.
Mm-hmm.
And now we're going to play, hopefully, Warriors on the Way. Let's see if we can get that on here.
La comunidad progresista pierde a un reconocido...
Nope.
Y'all.
Thank you. Thank you for listening to Tickling the Belly of the Beast from the heartland of Santa Cruz. You've been listening. We're on Freak Radio Santa Cruz, and we're always looking for donations. And they can be mailed to Free Radio Santa Cruz, P.O. Box 7811. And this is Warriors on the Way. Thank you for listening.
lum 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 lady lay, he lum lum lay yow, lum lady lay yow, liddy 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 liddy, hey a hoka hey, liddy 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 liddy. I see a white horse, an angel standing, goddess standing in the lotus sky, red as a dragon's eye, but light like a feather. And way across the horizon, deep in the hill.